Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed.
This is the Quality News Network. Israeli aircraft reportedly hit several sites near the Syrian border today as troops continued moving deeper into Lebanon. Meanwhile, fighting continued between Israeli ground troops and Hezbollah militants. It's part of an expanded ground offensive in which troops are expected to move about 18 miles across the border in an effort to drive out the militants. Cuban President Fidel Castro has temporarily ceded power to his younger brother, 75-year-old Raul, while he recuperates from surgery. His condition is unknown, but White House officials say they do not believe he's dead. In and around Baghdad, more than 70 people were killed today in clashes. An American and a British soldier are among the dead, as well as 20 Iraqi troops. Democratic leaders in both the House and Senate are now calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq by the end of the year. In southern Afghanistan, at least two British NATO soldiers were killed today in an ambush. Yesterday, NATO took over control of the area from U.S.-led coalition forces. In Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has officially rejected the resolution issued by the U.N. Security Council yesterday. It demands that Tehran abandon its nuclear program by August 31st or face possible diplomatic and economic sanctions. In Vietnam, officials may soon get their first oil refinery. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez visited the country today, saying his country will help Vietnam fight against American capitalism. Vietnam is seeking closer ties with the U.S. in an effort to boost the country's economy and hopes to gain entry into the World Trade Organization. In the Caribbean, a storm warning has been issued for some of the islands as Tropical Storm Chris nears. Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands are under storm watches. In the West, fire crews are battling almost 60 major wildfires that are burning out of control. For the first time in 3 years, federal land management agencies have put more of its employees on standby status in case extra help is needed. In Chicago, hundreds of residents have been evacuated from blacked-out apartments as the region copes with a heat wave. Temperatures today are expected to top 100 degrees in many parts of the East Coast. And in California today, British Prime Minister Tony Blair and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger announced they would work together to reduce global warming. Both the UK and California have suffered through record-high temperatures this summer. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network-quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson says the U.S. economy is slowing to a more manageable pace, but it's not heading toward a recession. He made his first public appearance today since he took over the post. The Fed meets next week to determine whether to raise interest rates again to protect against inflation. The Commerce Department blames high gas prices for weak consumer spending in June, but construction spending reached a higher rate, mostly due to government contracting. The nation's planned layoffs fell to 37,000 last month, a six-year low. The July figure is 64% lower than the 103,000 planned job cuts last July. Toyota sales passed Ford's in July for the first time, making Toyota the second-largest car maker in the nation. The automaker says high gas prices contributed to higher sales. Northwest Airlines flight attendants have rejected a contract that would cut pay and benefits by more than 20%. The airline says it's going ahead with the cuts starting today, a move that could trigger a strike. Eastman Kodak has posted a second quarter net loss of $282 million. The company is also eliminating another 2,000 jobs. And Sirius Satellite Radio is reporting a $238 million loss for its second quarter as the company continues to build its subscriber base. Light Sweet Crude settled at $74.91. At the close of Wall Street, the Dow was down 60 points, NASDAQ down 29, S&P 500 down 6. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kim.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights. They're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Broadcasting live from the Head On Radio Network office sauna. I am Bob Kincaid. Now, there are some things even air conditioners can't do anything about, and the two windows face where the studio is face the south and the west, and just throw another little bit of water on the rocks. Psst, psh, psh. Full warm, just a little bit warm, but we'll get through it. This is pretty doggone hot conversation radio anyway, so it's going to heat up the room by itself, right? Sure. Now, what's on tap for tonight? Well, here, even as I speak, we are preparing for our first interview of the evening. And look, I got to tell you, I'm excited about this. I'm excited about all our interviews. I won't bring an interview to you unless it is something that I feel like is worth not the interviewee's time, but your time. Because time is, as I have noted on a number of occasions, the single most finite resource on this planet. I don't get any more of it. You don't get any more of it. It's why I get so mad. It's why I don't suffer fools gladly, quite frankly. It's what makes ignorant people so tough to deal with, because you know they're taking your time, of which you're not getting any more. And so it's almost become a truism after any frustrating experience in our family, that the response after said frustrating experience, "Now, honest to God, this is real live USDA choice beef. It come all the way from Nebraska. I got it on special on the freezer on the back of my truck. I can sell you two boxes for the price of one." No, thank you. Or, if you become the Jehovah's Witness, you may have a chance to be one of only 140,000 Jehovah's Witnesses to actually make it into heaven. And you say, no, thank you. No, please, no. And eventually you close the door and you say, "Well, there's another 15 minutes of my life that I'll never get back." So I try to keep that kind of thing in mind when I schedule interviews. And I did not expect to get this interview. I sent in two box tops. I wrote the management team for this individual, this gentleman, this icon, and politely asked for an interview. And lo and behold, I think it's going to happen. Agnes should probably be dialing the phone even as I speak now. And toward that, well, what it boils down to is we're going to be joined in a few minutes, as soon as Agnes dials the phone number, by literally a rock and roll icon, Al Stewart. Al was there in the early days. He met the Beatles. He shared a boarding house with Paul Simon in the early days. Jimmy Page, dig this, Jimmy Page was a session musician for Al. Of course, he's had many of his own hits over the years. But the thing that fascinates me most about Mr. Stewart is his perspective. He has a profound ability to and a love for history and culture, and an ability to see the past through present eyes. And because of that, and because of what we do on this program, I felt like it would be an excellent opportunity to get perspective from places we wouldn't ordinarily get it. Now, we talked with our new friend Will Kimbrough last night. Will offered Southern perspective on the war, on the direction this nation is taking, and so I'd like to get a different perspective this time through. From a man with a profound ability to see through the fogs and mists of time. We're joined at this time by Mr. Al Stewart. Al, are you with us?
Yeah, hi, I'm here.
What a pleasure it is to talk to you, first of all. Thank you very kindly for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
I wrote off to your management team because I was sitting up late one night, and I had your 24 Karats album on.
Okay.
And this was as the conflagration in Lebanon and Israel was breaking out, and I was listening to Constantinople.
And yeah, that makes sense.
Well, maybe. God only knows what happens at 2 o'clock in the morning around here. But there was a line in there where you wrote, "It's like an old Greek tragedy held over by popular acclaim."
Yeah, well, that's exactly right, isn't it? I mean, going all the way back to the Trojan War, this has been going on for quite a long time, really. The wonderful story where Aeneas, the prince of Dardania, who was on the side of the Trojans, obviously, when Troy gets burned, Aeneas goes off and, after various travels and a romance with Dido, ends up founding the colony of Alba Longa in northern Italy, which, of course, becomes Rome. Now, the irony of all of this is that the descendants, some of them were even Aeneas' descendants, or the people who had traveled with him, go on to sack and destroy the Greek Empire 1,000 years later. So, even though the Trojans were defeated at the siege of Troy, they 1,000 years later they get their own back. And so with that in mind, and with all the other things that have gone since the Cyprus invasion and what have you, and then, of course, in 1453, the siege and conquest of Constantinople, I said it's like an old Greek tragedy held over by popular acclaim, because it seemed as though history suggested that to be so.
Do you, Al, do you think, I mean, is this, and from your perspective, is this some sort of predestined sort of thing, or is this mainly the ignorance of the ignorance of fools that makes it happen again and again and again and again?
Well, I think it's fun, really. I mean, for the participants, it's sort of like American football. people don't do things that they don't want to do, you know. One of the things that seems to be ingrained in human nature is that we like to march off and fight wars. I mean, we always have done. I suppose it's a human instinct.
That's from the 2000 Stanley Kubrick's 2001 with the chimpanzee standing with the bone in his hand next to the monolith. That would argue in favor of your position.
Well, it's not just my position; it's the position of humanity for at least the last 6,000 years, and probably for several million prior to that. I mean, I can't think. Actually, oddly enough, I'm standing here, and I was born in 1945, and this is the longest period of peace without a major war that I can think of, really, certainly for my country. I mean, I don't really count all these, you know, fooling around in South America things that we've done. I mean, it's, you know, without a full-scale European conflict, what is it, 60 years now? I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
And it would seem almost that Europe has gotten past it, and maybe the United States is moving into the birth pangs of empire. I think in a number of places you've lit some lights and put some perspective on things that we ought to be paying attention to. You know, there's a thread, and I don't want to sit here and play critic or play your records backwards or anything. But a number of times you've reflected on sort of the skullduggery or the mystical or mysterious qualities in what would seem to be circumstances of totalitarianism, Night Train to Munich, even the mysticism surrounding Year of the Cat, and is there something that is at work, or is there something? Is there a special appeal for you in those situations? The Running Man. Where someone has to operate against those kinds of overwhelming odds.
Yeah, I mean, these songs, all the songs you've just mentioned, and a lot of my other songs, for that matter. I mean, basically, they're cinema. I conceive them as movies, you know. So I'm looking for, you know, plot and character development and a whole lot of things that aren't really in popular music. I mean, I'm thinking of them as like. Thinking of these songs as mini movies, really. I mean, Running Man is, you know, it's a movie about chasing Nazis around South America. I mean, I write these things because no one else seems to. I have always liked history.
How did you make a conscious decision to carve that niche for yourself?
Well, I did look around one day and noticed that there were no historical folk rock singers in the world, and I thought, I wonder if there's, you know, room for one of one. To make a living, and that was about 35 years ago when I released Past, Present, and Future. And I don't know, people loved it. I mean, when I say people loved it, I mean, you know, sort of 0.1% of people loved it, but actually if you add them all together, it is just about enough for one historical folk rock singer to make a living, and I've done it ever since, so I'm proof of that.
And apparently it supports a pretty nice wine cellar from what,
yes,
I read.
Yes, it does. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like I get paid like a doctor, I suppose, you know, so I don't get rich, but I can make a living, and I can drink Chateau Margaux every now and then, so life can't be too bad. But, you know, I keep expecting someone else to break into it, but the people are so... people want, especially when you're young, you want sort of rapid success, and you want it to be on a grand scale. I mean, I just can't really see, Justin Timberlake writing Road to Moscow, because it would just take too long for him to become successful doing that. It's just, you know, so much easier to make dance music and, you know, get your face on the front cover of People magazine. And I resigned to the fact after 40 years that, you know, writing Road to Moscow or Lord Granville or On the Border or any of these other songs that I've written is never going to get my face on the cover of People magazine. But as I say, I mean, my basic reason for doing all this is because I like these songs, and if I didn't write them, no one else would.
Well, it strikes me that there's also a great deal of reading involved, and for the people out there who are desperately trying to get their faces on the cover of People magazine, there's a lot of human effort involved in staying in front of cameras. Obviously, you've done a tremendous amount of reading. Do you set off on a project, or are you more just of a sort of smorgasbord absorber of information?
Well, it depends what I'm writing. Now, Roads to Moscow was the most complicated one to research, and I think I probably did read about 40 books to put together that song. I mean, from the very obvious ones, the first thing I had to read was Guderian's memoirs, because I mentioned him in the song. I didn't want him in the wrong place.
Right.
And then I read Alexander Wirth's History of Russia at War, and, of course, William Shirer, that I think everyone has read, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And then Little Things for Color, The Deserted House by Ilya Chukovskaya. And I think some Arthur Koestler is in there, too. And then I thought, well, we better get the better get the views from the opposition. So I read Zhukov's memoirs, and that was a nice balance with Guderian's. And I put it all together, and eventually I had this song. Of course, the kernel of the song is a book by Alexander Solzhenitsyn called One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And that basically is that's the bones of the song. I was in some ways following Solzhenitsyn's capture and imprisonment as the main storyline of the song. Now, I hasten to add that all this research is not something I would dream of doing for, sort of most of the songs that I write. It's just that I think Roads to Moscow is an exaggerated case where I'd read most of these books before I even started writing the song, and then I just wanted to get color and detail, so I read a few more.
Well, I have such respect for your range and your interests. I think you still exist as the only rock and roller who has ever written a song about the Sirens of Titan.
Well, probably. I mean, but that one's pretty obvious because that's a Kurt Vonnegut novel.
Mm-hmm.
I went through a period of liking Kurt Vonnegut a lot. I think I read about the first 9 books that he wrote, and then somewhere along the line, I thought I've read so many of these things that I can pass on to something else now.
Well, one of the songs that, and frankly, we've bumped in and out of segments with it from time to time, Al, is your League of Notions.
Oh, yeah, well, I like that song.
I love that song because...
Well, that song seems more prescient to me every day. It's supposed to be describing the Versailles Peace Conference of 1919, but, you can play that song and it seems like it's current. It's very weird, because history does seem to repeat itself.
Well,
but I like the way that all these people come into that song, Clemenceau and
Lloyd George
and Lawrence of Arabia is even in there. I was thinking of Clemenceau the other day because he was... No, I'm just speaking off the top of my head. I don't have any information around me, but it seems to me that he was the mayor of Paris during the 1870 Paris Encirclement and Paris Commune. I don't know if that's true. Is that true? Do you know?
I believe he was around. You're talking about the time of the Franco-Prussian War.
Yes.
Yes.
I think he was the mayor of Paris. But anyway, whatever. By 1918, he was this little old gray-haired man, and he was defending the French interest. And he said this wonderful thing about the American president, Woodrow Wilson, who arrived in Europe with 14 points to make the world safe. And Clemenceau was overheard to say in a very loud voice, "Even God only had 10." And these are just great quotes. How can you resist putting something like that in a song?
Oh, without a doubt. And one of the things that League of Notions points up is there was a certain it was like a hubris involved in the carving up of Europe, the carving up of the Middle East, and we're very progressive, liberal-oriented, and we don't like George Bush very much on this program, Al. But the fact of the matter is that same sort of hubris and intransigence seems to be manifesting itself now in the Levant in the form of this nation's unwillingness to try to step in and stop that slaughter.
Well, I'm not sure, that America is obliged to start or stop wars anywhere in the world. I mean, it's a very famous line that George Will said about the first President Bush, which is one of my favorite things George Will has ever said. He wouldn't be one of your favorite people because
I read him, though.
But this was a great comment. And he was talking about the first George Bush, and George Bush the first was saying, what we need is a domestic czar, because he was spending so much time on foreign policy, he wanted someone to look after, the home fires, as it were. And George Will wrote, "In the past, we had just such a man. He was called the president."
Exactly. And well,
that's such a wonderful line.
Well, Jimmy Carter, or no, I believe it was Senator Chuck Hagel, came out today, and it was something I had said on the program a couple of weeks ago. And he said, "Whoever it is, this time is calling out for a great statesman."
Well, yes and no. It's a lot. I think. Well, I don't know. What do I know? It just seems a lot trickier. I mean, no one is asking Sweden or Peru to go and sort this out. And once you become the world's policeman, and possibly I say this because 100 years ago the British were in the same situation. Once you get yourself into that position, it's you're just stirring up trouble for yourself. I mean, you get to be the guy that everyone calls to, you know, go and put the fire sat all over the world. And eventually everyone ends up hating you. I mean,
right.
The British got drummed out of everywhere after 1947, 1948. And you know, probably justifiably too. But you get in this position by going in with goodwill and ending up owning the place, you know. So I'm not terribly sure that it's a good idea for, you know, sort of the great power of the day to act in this way. Also, and again, you probably have the advantage of me, I'm doing this from memory, but doesn't the Atlantic Charter specifically forbid America from having an empire?
It sort of does, but then again, we signed the Geneva Conventions, too.
Well, I'm not going to get into that.
I understand completely. Al, where is I noticed your tour schedule is incredibly busy these days. Is there an album out anytime soon?
Well, there was an album. I don't know. There was an album out last year, which is almost all historical. I liked it a lot.
We've been busy building this wee little network, and I did miss out on it. I saw the mention of it on your website.
I missed out on it entirely because it's probably still out there in the universe somewhere.
Right. Well, I intend to get my hands on it post haste.
Well, it's more in the past, present, and future mold. It's basically a historical record, although it's I don't know. It's not so in your face really as PPNF. But touring, yes. Oddly enough, I mean, for someone who's written so many World War II songs, I'm off to do, as you've probably seen, 11 shows in Germany later in the year. Which is always an interesting situation. I'm still occasionally able to make aging Nazis walk out on me. At least I was 20 years ago. I did the Roads to Moscow thing, complete with slides. So we had, Guderian and Hitler and Stalin and all these people were suddenly brought to life in a Munich concert hall. And it actually caused a bit of a kerfuffle and several people walked out.
Oh, that's amazing.
So I think, I mean, for a rock star to be able to cause controversy is relatively easy, but for a fairly humble folk singer with an acoustic guitar to drive people out of a concert hall is, I thought, something of a major achievement.
Well, and rather a badge of honor too, really.
Well, yes, considering who I was driving out in all likelihood, I thought it was pretty damn good.
But obviously, there's an interest in having you back there, and of course, you'll be at the Royal Albert Hall in London later this year. And you're touring up and down the West Coast. There's some dates in New York and Pennsylvania that I've noticed. I take it that touring is something that is still very important to you.
Well, I got to make a living.
Well, that too, but
it's. You get older and your fingers hurt a bit, and touring is very difficult. Not the playing. The playing's easy, but the traveling is very difficult. And the more so, just hauling equipment around. I mean, my suitcase weighs 57 pounds, and if you have to drag it up three flights of stairs in a boarding house every night, I mean, there's a point at which, you know, your back goes out and it hurts. And it basically, after a while, touring just physically hurts a lot. But I can't imagine not doing it because, it's what I do. If I didn't tour and play the guitar, I mean, I have no idea what I would do. I'd just look out of the window and just sort of watch the traffic go by.
Sit around and read books.
Well, you can read books. I always read books, but you have to physically get out and do things.
Well, and it's a real goodness for your fans as well, because you said, you know, that maybe not, you said, you know, just enough to support one rock and roller. But the fan sites out there on the web for you, Al, are really quite dedicated.
Yeah, after a while, you become this sort of cult thing, which is a polite way of saying that the mainstream have never heard of you. but I think in a way, what happens is the people who follow the more obscure artists tend to be a lot more dedicated to them. You know, the people who follow Richard Thompson or Tom Waits or Nick Drake's not with us anymore, but you know what I mean. These kind of people, they tend to be pretty devoted, whereas people who follow Britney Spears, you know, do it one week and then the next week it's Avril Lavigne, you know.
True.
Whereas if you're a Richard Thompson fan, you're a Richard Thompson fan forever. You know, it never goes away.
Well, I was looking. I was looking at your fan websites and so forth, and it struck me that your fan, of which I am one. Let me say, I mean, I got my copy of Year of the Cat in seventh grade, Al, and I've still got it. Your fan struck me as sort of, in a way, a more literate version of Jimmy Buffett's parrot heads, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, and of course they're only about, you know, sort of a. 0.1% of the fans that Jimmy Buffett has, but I think they are. I mean, we've got a lot of English teachers and a lot of history professors that turn up at my gigs, and you know, they're forever correcting my grammar and pointing out my mistakes, and I like that. I mean, it's wonderful, you know.
Well, I love the directions that I mean, speaking from a personal standpoint, that you took me, because I had never heard of Ernst Röhm, and I went and I read about Ernst Röhm after hearing the last day of June 1934.
Ah, well, Ernst Röhm's an interesting character.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the great sweep of history, it doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot, but the last day of June 1934 basically cemented Hitler in power. So the night meant a lot. It, interestingly enough, it was the other people he killed on that night, but some of which were perhaps more important, Gregor Strasser being one of them, who was stupid enough to believe in the socialist aspect of National Socialism and paid for that with his life. And Hitler got rid of, well, an old girlfriend, and who else did he get rid of? He got rid of, I think, one of his school teachers who'd given him bad marks in math. I mean, it's, when you look at the list of the 2,000 people who were killed, on June the 30th, 1934. There are some remarkable people on you know, like the Hitler, I think, probably personally put on the list. Ernst Röhm is top of the list because he was, you know, the leader of the Brown Shirts.
And a danger to Himmler. And
Well, I think it was more of a danger to... Well, I don't know. Ernst Röhm had this sort of idea in his head that he was perhaps more important in the grand scheme of things than Hitler wanted him to be. And the Brown Shirts were completely out of control. I mean, they were a rabble. And Hitler didn't want a rabble, he wanted an army. So he sent the SS after them, and everyone knows what happened next.
And, you know, and just another example, I found out about Nostradamus from you.
Wow. And well, Erika Cheetham, who was the great-granddaughter of a viceroy of India, wrote three books about Nostradamus, all of which sold very well. I met her when she was writing the first of them. And so I had access to, you know, she had her galleys all over her apartment, and I was just wandering around saying, okay, you know, what did he say that was really interesting? And she was, you know, offering me all these quotes, and I basically just assembled a whole bunch of them and stuck them into a song. And that song, I don't know if I believe any of it, you see, myself, but people latched onto it, as they do to mysterious and slightly outre.
Well, I'll hazard a guess that there are a lot of people who had never heard of Riyadh until you merged Nostradamus and the world goes to Riyadh, and of course,
immediately after that, the world did go to Riyadh.
Yeah, well, you know, and I stayed at a Holiday Inn there last night. That the whole world is in Riyadh right now.
That is so crazy. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's spooky because you write something in it, and you know, immediately it comes to pass. But I don't think there's any big deal about that. I think that the kind of things that I write songs about, I mean, you know, they're as likely to go the way that I suggest as not, you know. There are some things, I mean, on the border, you know, I was talking about the Rhodesian crisis as it was then and the Basque separatist movement that appears to have just got settled and the decline and fall of the British Empire. And I just didn't think that Rhodesia was going to be a place that would work. And because Stevie Wonder had a song out at the same time where he declares peace will come to Zimbabwe, and as it happens, he was wrong. But on the border, when I play it, it still appears to be pretty accurate.
It does indeed. And of course, old admirals. I'm not exaggerating when I say that lines from your songs run through my head. I was watching CNN the other day and saw one of these CNN military analysts, General so-and-so, retired, and old admirals went running through the back of my brain.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was based on the life of Jackie Fisher, Sir John Fisher,
right.
Who was the first Sea Lord in 1914.
shuffled out of the way by Winston Churchill.
And for no good reason, too, because it was after the Gallipoli campaign, which was actually Churchill's idea. I think Fisher was against the idea, but Fisher got the blame for it, and he was shuffled out of the way, as you say, and he never came back. But Fisher was actually responsible for the dreadnought.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that I don't think there was a single dreadnought sunk from the British Navy in the whole of World War One. Although there was only one significant naval engagement, which was Jutland. But they never lost the dreadnought. So maybe Fisher was right about it after all.
It spoke well for him. And were he living in this age, he would have a comfy job as an analyst for the BBC or CNN or Fox.
Yeah. You know what? I can't see him doing that. He was an interesting character. He was like dancing on the deck of the ship. I mean, it was. And he'd come out in the evening and just do these amazing dances. I just can't see.
Well, he transitioned through a fascinating period in the British Navy because he literally did start out under sail.
Yes, he did, on the old Calcutta. It was not in 1853, as I said in the song, because I was looking for a rhyme. It was actually in 1854.
But
yes, he did.
To see that and go from that to coal-fired or oil-fired steamships, must have been a mind-boggling transition for him.
Well, it was. That was mind-boggling time. I mean, there was a point around the 1890s when the torpedo, became a significant weapon, where the British Navy realized that their gunnery range was 1,000 yards or whatever, and the torpedo, had a range of 2,000 yards. And what this effectively meant was that the entire British fleet was obsolete. So Fisher's answer to this was to build these, sort of enormous, great floating tin cans with huge guns that could fire shells about 18 miles, and that really was the end of that,
And that takes some vision.
Fisher's first, he had three laws, and I can't remember them now, one of them was absolutely magnificent. They were very simple. I mean, like a lot of great generals, will, fill up pages and pages of, the orders of the day with verbiage, but Fisher only had like three lines, and I remember what the first one was. It was sink everything.
Yeah, and don't get sunk yourself.
I mean, the man has just said in two words everything that needs saying in a battle,
Exactly. Well, as you look toward, obviously with the touring and everything, you are going forward. The album has been out for a year, and please help me with the name of the album, Al.
Yeah, the album is called A Beach Full of Shells, because the main track on the record is set in 1915, and it begins with the death of Rupert Brooke, who was a famous pre-World War I British poet. Brooke wrote, "If I should die, think only this of me. There is some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. And in that dust, a richer dust concealed," and so on and so forth. I don't think Rupert Brooke was a terrific poet, but he was quite important in the scheme of things of getting the English worked up about World War One. And, of course, at the end of World War One, a very, very different poet called Wilfred Owen emerges who, paints the war in its true colors. And it's the difference between the way that World War One was viewed in the beginning and how it was viewed, when it was all over, that forms the basis of the song, which is called Somewhere in England, 1915.
Well, I've got to hear this now, Al.
I think you'd like it.
I know I will. One other tune from Dancing into 1939.
Oh yeah. Laughing into 1939.
Laughing into 1939. I'm sorry. Do you think? And I know you don't go in for the mysticism and stuff, but you think there might be some little kid out there learning his first couple of chords on a guitar who might wind up cutting records 30 years from now, talking about how we laughed into 2007. Are we at? I mean, you said it's been 60 years since Europe was eaten up in a conflagration. Are you optimistic about our ability to quell this stuff, or does the stuff in the Middle East keep getting worse? Do you think?
Well, I mean, it's the $64 billion question, whichever way you want to look at it. I mean, my guess is as good as yours, or yours is as good as mine. I mean, I have no idea. No one has any idea. It seems intractable. Both positions seem fairly logical to me. I mean, I think, boiling it all down, it comes down to the right of return. You know, the Palestinians lived there. They were thrown out. They feel that they should be allowed to come back. This is entirely logical. I mean, you can't fault the logic at all. Say you were in your house one night, and a burglar came in with a gun and said, "You don't live here anymore. Give me the keys and go away and never come back." I mean, you know, somewhere down the line, you'd say, "No, wait a second, that's my house." So I understand that.
Yes.
But then, of course, if all the Palestinians come back, if the Israelis, you know, they become a minority in their own state, that's the end of the Jewish state. Boom, you know. So I understand that position too. And you can't get round. You can't get round any of this by negotiations, I don't think. I mean, it doesn't seem possible. So what's the alternative? Well, the alternative is you gradually escalate until there's some major war, and if one side manages to kill enough of the others, then they're the ones who live there. Now, that's how it's tended to work over the ages. I mean, it doesn't make me happy, but I'm just not sure that, you know, given the leadership and given the political will, you know, there's any other logical, you know, destiny to all of this. I mean, what do you think?
I look back. We talked a moment ago about Constantinople, that line that's in there, the uninvited guests are breaking up the feast.
Yeah.
The repetitiousness of all of this is frankly, Al, terrifying to me.
Well, yeah, it is.
I look in particular at Athens and the start of the Peloponnesian War. Far more, you know, there's a lot of people out there going, "Oh, yeah, the United States, now we're ancient Rome." And I think if we read a little bit more closely, there are many more parallels to be drawn between the United States and the Athenian democracy. The golden age of Greece, and it was over 100 years later.
Because I love the Athenian democracy. I mean, I think it was one of the best systems of government ever known to man. And besides which, if you're going to talk about the Peloponnesian War, the Spartans were complete fascists. I mean.
Yes, absolutely. And so you've got this democracy that marches off. I mean, you know, the Melian dialogue, where the Melians say to the Athenians, small nations do what they, or maybe I've got it backwards, small nations do what they must, great nations do what they will. It was hard not to read that in March of 2003 as we were ramping up the thing with Iraq. But if you go a little further down the line and you take a look at what happens to the Athenian democracy in Syracuse, it becomes a very frightening thing, because within 100 years the Athenian democracy's gone.
Yeah, and within 200 years Syracuse is gone, conquered by the Romans.
Right. And you know, 100 years later, well, hello, Alexander.
Yeah, there you go. But all of this is, in retrospect, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know that there's a sort of a conceit that human beings, you know, gradually get because they become more technologically proficient. The feeling is that they might actually be growing wiser. I see absolutely no sign of that. I mean, I think that we're not.
Well, no, Alfred Nobel put paid to that, didn't he?
Well, we're not clever or more stupid than we ever were. I mean,
monkeys with bones.
Well, what did Alfred Nobel give us? Come on, give me a break here.
Yeah,
wasn't it dynamite?
Yeah, TNT, and it was going to end war. Because it was such a horrific weapon, no one would ever dare use it.
You know what? They said that about the crossbow. I remember there was a papal edict against the crossbow in something like about 1170 A.D., because this was such a fearsome weapon. You could knock a knight off a horse at 100 paces. It was thought that it would basically eliminate chivalry, and it might even eliminate the other ruling classes. And so the Pope banned the crossbow. And what happened? Absolutely nothing. I think when the genie is out of the bottle, you can't put it back in again.
And it could very well be that the genie has been out of the bottle the whole time.
Yes, I mean, it goes back to what we said, what I said at the beginning of the conversation, which is that, as far as I can tell, human beings actually quite like war, and if the majority is in favor of enforcing their position through force, through power, which they seem to be in almost every country in the world, the minority, you know, even if they're the sensible ones, you would think. I have my doubts as to whether, you know, their voices really mean a whole hell of a lot, you know.
Well, I've wondered that as well in the last couple of years. And
you have all these people saying all I mean, Bertrand Russell said the world was going to end in 1948 after the Soviets got the bomb. I mean, there have been a lot of people, sort of saying you can't do this for a long time. But they basically stand in the middle of the street with a signpost saying stop, and they get trampled to death. So.
Well, and the other side of that, Al, is that, and I'm seeing a lot of it these days, there are the people on the so-called religious right who are out there, again, standing on the street corner with behold, the end of the world is nigh. And they've been standing on the same street corner for 150 years.
Well, also people on the religious left, for that matter. I mean, if you count communism as a religion,
Yeah.
So right and left, I mean, after a while, they begin to lose some sort of currency, I think. But, because people hide behind them as though they're trenches and positions. But they're not really. It's more fluid than that. But I just think that you have a majority of people who just, the testosterone starts working and they go, I'm not standing for this, you're wrong, and I'm going to knock your head in, And it's just pretty much, it's there in every country, unless it's somehow edited out of the human psyche. I think it's probably gone forever.
Well, we mentioned Kurt Vonnegut a little bit ago, and he's taken the position that the human race is a virus that the Earth is desperately trying to reject.
I think artists are pretty fatalistic, and I think writers in particular are. I mean, they have a fairly sardonic view of the world. Vonnegut might be right.
I'm beginning to wonder, Al. I certainly thank you for all the time that you've spent with us this evening. It's certainly been a thrill for me. In seventh grade, with on the border, turning on the old 33. I never dreamed that I would have this conversation. So again, I thank you very, very much. You're on the road to Littleton, Colorado, Anaheim, San Diego, San Juan, Santa Monica, and that's just September.
Yeah, but the real October, November, there are 25 shows in Europe, so that's going to be a bit of a schlep, I think.
I would think so, but I know that there are a lot of people out there that will be thrilled to pieces to see you. Are you do you still work with a lot of your old bandmates, or is this strictly you?
They come and go. I've been working the last three albums with Lawrence Juba, who is an amazing guitar player. I've seen over the years to have had all these great guitar players.
He's the best three guitar players I've ever heard.
He's very good. I began, because the first guitar player I ever worked with was Jimmy Page. That's a pretty good start. And then Richard Thompson was the next one. That's pretty damn good, too.
So yeah.
And then Peter White and Tim Rennick and all these people. And now Lawrence Juba. And Lawrence will be at the Albert Hall with me and doing some of the other shows. And there'll be a few other musicians.
Lawrence was formerly with Wings, right?
Yeah, he was with Wings.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the we've touched on a lot of the lyrical qualities of your music. That's the other thing though that puts it all together, I think, Al, is that the musicianship that you have always had has been just magnificent.
Well, I liken that onto the Kennedy administration vis-a-vis the Nixon administration. And I mean, that probably sounds terribly pretentious, but what I mean is that Kennedy's idea was to surround himself, with the best minds that he could get and listen to what they had to say and then make a decision. Nixon's idea was to make the decision and surround himself with the most mediocre minds that he can find in order that they would agree with him.
and you've taken the former path.
I think you should take the former path rather than the latter. So what I've done is I've basically always tried to work with, the best musicians on the face of the planet, even if it meant that I didn't get to play very much myself on my records, because they know so much more, what to do than I do.
Well, you and they have certainly brought a lot to life in the past 30, 35 years, and I, on behalf of my audience, I thank you very, very kindly, because when I announced that you were going to be on the program, there was a lot of excitement and a lot of, oh, yeah, because as you mentioned earlier on, it's not a problem to turn on the tube and hear from Justin Timberlake or see Britney almost drop her baby on the ground. But to hear from someone with real perspective and real what I consider to be artistic genius is a rarity, and I so thank you very much for participating in this process.
Well, my pleasure. I hope things work out better than either of us think they will, and best of luck to all your listeners.
Thank you very kindly, Al, and the very best on your tour.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Okay, I'm going to take an extended break while I just... So,
this is wonderful.
This is art. I mean, the man is an artist. If all you've ever heard is Year of the Cat or On the Border, you really do owe it to yourself to go out there and crank out a few more royalties for Al. You heard that his suitcase weighs 50,000 pounds. Getting it up three flights of stairs on tour is a bitch now. watch my mouth. But seriously, I think we'll play some cuts from Al through the course of the evening. We're going to go to a break, and we're going to go out with a little extended dose of one of the songs I mentioned with him, called The Last Day of June, 1934. See if you have ever heard anyone put this level of thought and musicianship into a piece of music. This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm like fan Bob Kincaid.
The morning is humming, it's quarter past nine. I should be working down on the fines, yeah, but I'm flying here with a good friend of mine, watching the sun in her hair. I pick the greens from the hills to the sea. The fields of France, they're a home to me, yeah, but today, flying here, such a good place to be. I can't go anywhere. And as we slept in an hour of embrace, like some old and familiar place, reflecting all of my dreams in a face like the fog. On the last day of June 1934. Just out of Cambridge, in a narrow country lane, a bottle green Bentley in the driving rain, slips and skips round a corner, pulls straight again, heads up the drive to the door. The lights of the party shine over the fields, while lovers and dancers watch Catherine Wheels and argue realities to be their heels. In a world that's finished with war, and a lost wind of summer blows into the streets, as the tramps in the alleyways, rich in silk sheets. You're a blind sleeping, you feel heartbeats through the floor. On the last day of June 19, on the night that Ernst Röhm died, voices rang out in the rolling Bavarian hills. Swept through the city and danced in the gutters, grown strong like the joining of will. Oh, I could wave like a roar in the distance, in moonlight carved out of steel, singing only so long and so long. You don't know me, how long, how long. You can't hold me, I'm strong, now I'm strong, stronger than yours. Now by the banks of the Rhine, dipping my feet in the cold stream of time, and I know I'm a dreamer, I know I'm out of line with the people I see everywhere. The couples pass by me, they're looking so good, their arms around each other, they head for the woods. They don't care who Ernst Röhm was, no reason they should. Just a shadow that hangs in the air. But I thought I saw him cross over the hill with a whole ghostly army of men at his heel. And struck in the moment, it seemed to be real, like the fall. of June 1934. The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business, anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
Howdy, this is Baxter Black, and if you're like me, you're concerned that the environment we enjoy today may not be around for our children and grandchildren. All the new technology in the world can't create more sky over our heads or new oceans. The Earth's natural resources, fresh water, land, and even the air we breathe are limited. Voluntary family planning improves the health of women and their children. It also helps slow population growth, which is good for our planet. So help ensure that people everywhere have access to the information and services they need to plan their families and help build a healthy future for us all. Population Action International is working to promote voluntary family planning around the world. Visit us at www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
We often hear claims Muslims don't condemn terrorism,
and that Islam condones violence.
As Muslims, we want to state clearly
that those who commit acts of terror in the name of Islam are betraying the teachings of the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad.
We reject anyone of any faith who commits such brutal acts,
and will not allow our faith to be hijacked by criminals.
Islam is not about hatred and violence. It's about peace and justice.
This is Lee Hamilton
and Ron Saracen of the U.S. Capitol Historical Society.
Our Capitol has hosted some of the great debates of our history,
and we're both proud to have served here.
But there is no guarantee that representative democracy will simply continue on.
We all need to ask ourselves whether we're doing our part as citizens,
staying informed, engaging elected officials, and being active in our communities.
It's our history,
and it's also our future.
Get involved.
Just rearrange.
This is a quality news network. Israeli aircraft reportedly hit several sites near the Syrian border today as troops continued moving deeper into Lebanon. Meanwhile, Israeli ground troops have moved several miles into Lebanon, and thousands of reservists are preparing to join in the fighting. Cuban President Fidel Castro has temporarily ceded power to his younger brother while he recuperates from surgery. White House officials say they do not believe he's dead. In and around Baghdad, more than 70 people were killed today in clashes. The deadliest incident was a roadside bombing that killed all 24 passengers on a bus. An American and a British soldier are among the dead, as well as 20 Iraqi troops. In Iraq, the son of Montana Senator Max Baucus was killed in fighting over the weekend. The Department of Defense said the 28-year-old Marine died Saturday during combat operations in Anbar province. In 2002, Senator Baucus voted to authorize war in Iraq. In Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has officially rejected a resolution issued by the UN Security Council yesterday. It demands that Tehran abandon its nuclear program by August 31st or face possible sanctions. In Vietnam, officials may soon get their first oil refinery. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez visited the country today, saying his country will help Vietnam fight against American capitalism. A Senate committee approved Vietnam's entry into the World Trade Organization yesterday. A full vote in Congress is expected this week. In China, authorities have slaughtered 50,000 dogs, sometimes beating them to death. That comes after three people died of rabies. Only 3% of dogs are vaccinated against the disease. In Washington today, the Senate has voted to open more than 8 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico to oil and gas drilling. But the measure still has to be reconciled with another measure passed by the House in June, which calls for even more drilling. Negotiations are expected to start in September. In southeastern Florida, the state has purchased about 115 square miles of wilderness for environmental conservation. Conservationists are praising the $350 million deal. In the West, fire crews are battling almost 60 major wildfires that are burning out of control. Some federal land management employees are on standby status in case extra help is needed. And in Chicago, hundreds of residents have been evacuated from blacked-out apartments as the region copes with the spreading heat wave. You're listening to QNN.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network-quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson says the U.S. economy is slowing to a more manageable pace, but it's not heading toward a recession. His comments came during his first public appearance since taking over the post last month. The Fed meets next week to determine whether to raise interest rates again to protect against inflation. High gas prices have left Americans with less to spend on other items. That's according to the Commerce Department, which reported weak consumer spending in June for the fourth month in a row. The nation's planned layoffs fell to 37,000 last month, a six-year low. Toyota sales passed Ford's in July for the first time, making Toyota the second-largest car maker in the nation. The Tokyo automaker says high gas prices contributed to higher sales. Northwest Airlines flight attendants have rejected a contract that would cut pay and benefits by more than 20%. The airline says it will go ahead with the cuts starting today. Eastman Kodak has posted a second quarter net loss of $282 million. The company is also eliminating another 2,000 jobs. Fox News has reached a $250,000 settlement with four women who said they were sexually harassed at the workplace. Light sweet crude settled at $74.91 today, and at the close of Wall Street, the Dow was down 60 points at 11,126, NASDAQ down 29 points at 2062, S&P 500 down 6 points at 1271. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Well, as the punchline to the old joke goes, oh, let's just do the whole old joke. Guy dies and goes to hell. Satan shows him to the first room, and he opens the door, and there's a bunch of people standing on their heads on concrete floors, you know, moaning and agony, you know. And he says, you can have this room for all eternity, or you can have the room that the door is still closed on. The guy says, that looks terrible. And he says, show me the other room. And Satan opens the door, and the guy's, and it's a room full of caca, and people are standing knee-deep in it drinking coffee. He goes, well, I'll take this room. The guy walks in, he's standing there knee-deep, and he's got his first cup of coffee, and a little demon comes in and goes, all right, coffee break's over, back on your heads. Coffee break's over, back on your heads. Let's go to the phones. Jim is with us. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, what a transition from Al Stewart to that.
Well, you know, that's my genius.
Mercy. You know, I have read about Night of the Long Knives, and I've seen it portrayed or dramatized in films such as Luchino Visconti's The Damned, but I never heard the song about Ernst Röhm and his band of SA men that were ambushed by Hitler on June 30th, 1934, like that.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Well, I owe a considerable debt to Al Stewart, because he sent me off down historical trails that I probably never would have studied. And, you know, that's the power of rock and roll when it's done the right way.
Well, you know, I remember him for The Year of the Cat and things like that, but never these songs. And I had no idea that he was as knowledgeable about history. I mean, I heard some of the names mentioned, Solzhenitsyn, everything from Solzhenitsyn, actually, to the English poet Rupert Brooke, for whom my cat is named, by the way. And it was a very interesting interview, quite frankly.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We try to do things a little out of the ordinary, Jim.
Well, yeah, it is. I've got something for you that you might find interesting.
All right.
And it ties in with what we were talking about earlier. And it has to, and it's a quotation about the dogma of Christianity.
Okay.
Okay. The dogma of Christianity gets worn away before the advances of science. Gradually, the myths crumble. All that is left to prove that in nature, there is no frontier between the organic and inorganic. When understanding the universe has become widespread, when the majority of men know that the stars are not sources of light, but worlds, perhaps inhabited by worlds like ours, then the Christian doctrine will be convicted of absurdity. The man who lives in communion with nature necessarily finds himself in opposition to the churches, and that's why they're headed for ruin, for science is bound to win.
Whose words are those?
Would you like to guess?
No.
Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, I figured as much.
Hitler's Table Talk, page 51, from Alan Bullock's History of Studying, Hitler, A Study in Tyranny, page 632.
Well, you know, the
interesting.
It is very interesting. You know, the fact, you know, he was a monster. You know, he's surely, you know, it, for those of us who have read Dante, you know, if you transpose Dante into the modern world, surely Hitler has to be in that last little circle of hell. By the same token, well, are you familiar? And I can't remember the man who first posited it, but the Gaia theory of life on Earth. Are you familiar with that, Jim?
No.
Well, he posits that the entire Earth itself is a living organism.
Hmm.
And I don't have much trouble with that, because you and I cannot imagine the life of a single red corpuscle.
No, that's sort of above my pay grade, actually.
So neither can we imagine being little more than a corpuscle on the planet. And of course, Carl Sagan's brilliant work, A Pale Blue Dot, really drives that home. And when you see, and you know, you can see the photograph that engendered the writings just by Googling Pale Blue Dot, and it's a photograph taken from Voyager on the way out of the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally, you know, it might be two, it's a dot, 2 pixels wide. And that's us. That's every single person of this multiple billions of human beings getting and spending and laying waste their days, as Wordsworth put it.
Well, yeah, well, that's Earth and life upon it. So what can you say? It all sounds pretty insignificant, doesn't it?
It does. And when you know, and I think if we if some people would contemplate that insignificance a little bit more, we'd be less likely to maybe Al's right. Maybe we do war because we like war. Was it Patton, Jim?
Of course we like war.
Was it Patton who said, "God help me, I love it so"?
No, it's reputedly, yes. I mean, you know, it gave him a job, it gave him something to do, and he certainly was anxious to get into it. After he'd gotten in trouble over after slapping that soldier in Sicily, and he certainly was upset about not being able to get a command of the Pacific. Of course, you know, fate took care of that. But I mean, yeah, there are people who absolutely love war, and you know, because they considered war to be, unfortunately, in their eyes, not mine, but they considered to be war as the product of man's highest and noblest ambition. Adolf Hitler was one of them.
Well, and you know, Al touched on something else. He, World War One starts with Rupert Brooke, but it ends with Wilfred Owen. You know, who writes? What was it? Doggone it! Dulce et
decorum est pro patria mora.
Yes, dulce et decorum est, and that is just
one's country.
Yeah, and the title is taken from a Latin author's phrase who was out there putting out the standard propaganda that sweet and noble it is to die for one's country. But then Wilfred Owen turns around, and if you read the entire poem, it's the most stinging indictment of warfare that ever has been had.
Oh, without question. I mean, yeah, I remember that, the old Norton anthology.
And I think maybe, you know, part of the dichotomy or part of the problem is, you know, I don't know, you know, they say Patton said, God help me, I love it so. And, you know, generals say that kind of thing. Privates and grunts up to their necks in the muck tend to say, I want to go home.
They do. I mean, that's just one reason that Omar Bradley was considered to be a very popular general, because they called him the soldier's general. He didn't look like a general. He really didn't, in many cases, act like a general. And he understood the plight of the American dog face, as they were known then.
Yeah,
Patton was a little more... Well, Patton was slightly crazy. You'd have to be.
Yeah, and MacArthur was an elitist snob. You know, what did Eisenhower say? He was the best drama coach I ever had.
Yeah.
And MacArthur said of Eisenhower, the best file clerk I ever had. But, you know, MacArthur was a terrible snob. But
they used to call him Dugout Doug because of his, you know, his position on Corregidor. That was his epithet, was Dugout Doug, because they said when the first shell exploded, he headed for the bunker.
Yeah,
and then took off for Australia on that submarine, and you know, but one thing about MacArthur was that, you know, he certainly was one of the greatest gifts that we could have ever given Japan, because he was a marvelous administrator.
Yeah, well, once he got done with all the hangings,
not much hanging really took place. Not really. As a matter of fact, the Japanese war trials were nothing compared to the Germans.
No, not in scope, but.
MacArthur really didn't do that much.
Well, the justice that MacArthur did mete out was rather ruthless. people, you know.
He was pretty kind, Bob. As a matter of fact, one of the things about him was the thing I admire the most about MacArthur and his Japanese policy was, number one, he realized the significance of allowing the Japanese to keep their emperor. And he did not wait for the emperor to come to see him. He went to see the emperor. He went to see Hirohito.
But the place that I was going to, Jim.
But in a couple of years, you had baseball being the national sport of Japan, and Japan becoming the nation that it is today.
Yeah, true. And if you hear our good friend Robert dial in from Japan from time to time, he will tell you that that is a culture in trouble. But the place that I was leading to, Jim, was the generals love the war. The dog faces, the grunts, whatever you want to call them, don't. But more than anything else, the people who really, really love the war, and we've certainly seen this since March 2003, Jim, the people who really, really love the war are the ones who are busy not fighting it. You know, and this goes, you know, there are evidences of this in throughout history, but most clear and present to us, for instance, the fine ladies and gentlemen who rode out to the hills overlooking Manassas to watch those southern heathens get their butts handed to them by the glorious Grand Army of the Republic, and were quickly overtaken by that army in full-fledged retreat.
Well, that was a bit of a sticky wicket, wasn't it?
Yeah, Mark Twain nailed it right on the head in the War Prayer when he spends the bulk of the piece describing the orgiastic love and adoration for the concept of glorious war manifested in American towns and cities across the continent. And we saw it again in the run-up to March 2003, Jim. We saw support the troops rallies, and we saw Dixie Chick record burnings and just orgasms of warlike
Well, that's the way it always is when a war started. You have bands playing, you have soldiers marching, you have colors flying, and you have people chanting slogans. And then when it really gets underway, the only people who really are really truly happy are the people who make the weapons and make tremendous amounts of money off of these contracts that are let to the Defense Department. And, you know, unfortunately, these wars, which were so important at their inception, at their end, a lot of people can't remember what they were about and why they were fought.
Right. And as a consequence, you know, if it is worth it, and I want, you know, I wonder if after the conversation with Al, I wonder if there is a movement in this country that thinks it would be worth it to end warfare. You know, if we just enjoy them, if the majority of people enjoy them and the people who stand in the way of them are mere cultural nuisances, what does that say for Dr. King? What does that say for Gandhi? What does that say for Jesus Christ?
Well, I mean, you know, for example, it was and one of the finest speeches that Hitler ever gave was to Roosevelt. And this was after Germany had left the League of Nations. And he said, "You, Mr. Roosevelt, you tell me that you settle your problems by peaceful means and sitting at the council table? Did you resolve your problems with the Sioux Indian tribes or the problems with the North and the South by doing that?" And, you know, he just went on. He said, "And your own president proposed an organization of which you yourself are not a member or did not wish to join. April 23rd, 1939.
I don't doubt it.
That was the finest speech he ever made. And I don't admire Hitler, but I do admire his oratory. And I do admire that speech that day. It was the last great speech he would ever give, because from that point forward, he would have to make his way in history as a warrior, which thankfully ended in the ruins of Berlin with the Führerdämmerung. But still, he could.
Good word.
Speech.
Good word, Jim. Führerdämmerung.
He could turn out a speech. And, you know, as I said before, and as we've discussed before in your old show, that film, Leni Riefenstahl, The Triumph of the Will, when you see that movie and you see those parades and you see those movements and things, It's a very beguiling thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's beguiling enough that back when George was landing on the deck...
Swept me off my feet.
Yeah, back when George was landing on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln, you're familiar with the Leni Riefenstahl film. You know darn good and well that that first shot of his plane coming down onto the deck of that carrier was straight out of Leni Riefenstahl's playbook.
Yeah, I can see the Junker 88 flying over Nuremberg now.
Yeah.
Well... I don't know.
And something, yeah. a little pop culture thing you may be fascinated to note. Jodie Foster is actually at work on a film of the life of Leni Riefenstahl.
I'm not surprised at that. She's an extremely astute, and she's a very, very, there's a great deal of depth to her that people just don't even realize. I mean, she's an extremely intelligent woman. And with an artistic and historical perspective that is not to be believed. And everything she's ever put her hand to, I think, is wonderful. I mean, Home for the Holidays, that's a wonderful movie.
I don't know if you've seen it or not. I have. Jim, I'm going to roll along. Thank you so much for all your thoughts.
Well, appreciate the interview. And, you know, I didn't realize that The Night of the Long Knives had been lionized also in verse.
That is off of... it's either off of Past, Present, and Future or Modern Times, but the entire Al Stewart catalog is worth having.
By the way, incidentally, after killing Rome, Hitler offered his wife and sister, I mean, not his wife, but his mother and sister, a pension. They refused it.
I'll be darned.
Because, you know, Rome, of course, wanted to lead a second revolution and felt that Hitler had betrayed the initial revolution. That was their problem.
Indeed. Thanks, Jim.
Take care.
Have a good one. Okay, let's roll it right along and go straight to David in Maine. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Bob.
How are you?
Well, I'm all right. I didn't know Al Stewart was going to be on tonight, so I missed that interview. I guess I'm going to have to catch it in the archive.
Yeah, I had a blast.
That's good. I was going to mention... the government releases hundreds of September 11 attack photos, emails, videos. Top story on Raw Story.
Okay.
And I just think that's weirdly timed after that hawk fest of C-SPAN.
Well, yeah, and it ran again this evening.
Oh, gee.
It ran at 6:10 Eastern.
I'd like to get a track total of how many people... you know, I think the 9/11 people got lucky in this respect because everyone was talking about Lebanon, Israel, and very few people, and Mel Gibson. Very few people touched on the C-SPAN thing.
From what I can tell, it's been hit pretty hard.
Oh, really?
Yeah, their viewership has been pretty stirring, and there were mass emailings. I got three or four of them saying, you know, tell the world about August the 1st. So.
I mean the attack dogs. That's what I.
Oh! I misunderstood you. I'm sorry, David.
Yeah, I'm talking about you know, the way the right picks up a story, they all get it in their email box and they're like, all right, we got to go after this story. Well, you see, the problem with that being focused on one story, this is why I think they got lucky, is because you have three big stories. You got the Mel Gibson, you got the Lebanon and Israel, and then you got whatever else is on the radar. So I'm just saying I think they got lucky in that respect because really, if I was the right and I was Rush Limbaugh, I would have a field day. I literally would have a field day. Like you're actually promoting Alex Jones and all these people.
Yeah.
Oh, and they're after the Jews again. I mean, it would just be so easy.
But of course, it's going. Yeah. Mel is one of Russia's people, so you know, getting after the. Yeah. That's going to be a tough card to play. They're after the Jews again.
And I'm telling you, they're never going to want it to end. So even, you know what, even if they came out with a solution and they said, okay, the government did it, yeah, but who in the government? I don't think it was those people. And it would just be never ending because the money, it's too much. I don't think people realize this. This is why it's not good to get hooked into these groups because you'll be there forever.
Well, and you see, I'm gonna be candid about this. I haven't jumped on any. Well, first of all, I don't do bandwagons.
Right.
But secondly, I'm not going to jump on any of these for a very simple reason. I am concerned with the future of the United States. For good or ill, 9/11 is in the past of the United States.
Exactly.
If I jump on one of these bandwagons and it becomes in many ways like something out of Life of Brian, where it's follow the shoe, no, follow the branch, you know, and no, you know, that 9/11 guy is wrong and he's a heretic and he deserves to die because actually no, Building 7 committed suicide, and I cannot allow myself to be pulled into that, David.
You know the sad fact is people think we need another 9/11. No, we don't. That's just a summer concert show, basically. We don't need another 9/11.
Oliver Stone has literally already done the movie.
I know. There's your propaganda right there.
We got the Flight 93 movie. You know what?
I know. Here's the thing that people should be talking about. The thing when everything happened. The news anchors should have turned around. If this was the 60s, this would have happened, Bob. If this was the late 60s, you know what happened. And said, yeah, but Iraq and Afghanistan didn't attack us. It was Saudi Arabia. What are we doing?
Yeah.
But we didn't do that because we had – it went into the buzzsaw. And this goes into my main thing that I wanted to talk about also radical ideas – and implementing them in radical ways. I was watching this story by Stephen King, and it's on Nightmares and Dreamscapes. And the premise was this guy in a video camera, and he was telling the story about a disturbing tale, how his brother had basically come up with this idea to get rid of all wars. And the way he did it was he would control them somehow by messing with the water supply. Now, I think the metaphor that Stephen King was putting forward, now I'm not going to tell you what happened, the results of that, but basically this super genius ends up making the world, which is the title of the story, a whole big mess. And the problem that people don't understand, when you aggressively radicalize something with a new idea, it sounds good on paper, but it's not good on grass turf or astroturf or whatever.
Well, and the other side of the coin, David, is that there is, Richard Clark. You remember Richard Clark? The guy who begged for a meeting with Bush and Condi to discuss Osama in March of 2001, but they didn't want anything to do with him because they were busy building missile defense systems. At some point, I can't remember what publication it was in. It's probably findable on the internet. What isn't? He wrote an actual scenario for the coming, 10, 15 years, and where the war on where the so-called terror war goes in the United States if things are left as they are. And it wasn't another, you know, it wasn't another plane into a building. It was backpack bombs in the Mall of America. It was dynamite belts at the grand opening of the great big new Walmart Supercenter.
These designers of this plan, and I know people don't want to hear this, but they're no different than the Osama bin Laden and the fundamentalists, because they talk loudly about what they're going to do. You can just go to Project for New American Century, and they have updates frequently. I was reading one on military defense strategy. Bob, you have to look at it. It's insane. They have these graphs, and they talk about the problems that we'll be facing if we change this and we change that, but this will be the advantage over that. And I'm like, good Lord.
Well, they've done it with Iraq, David. Of course, we're not looking at Iraq right now because
we're not looking at Iraq.
Mel Gibson got drunk and said he hates Jews.
That's right.
But the fact of the matter is, it was, a couple of weeks ago, I'm reading an article where the real, hardcore acid-dropping right-wing weirdos surrounding George Bush had come to the conclusion that this disaster that has become Iraq is exactly where we want to be. Oh, we've got them now. Because now this lets us really clamp down. Yeah, that's it. And it turns into this John Lovitz thing. Yeah, that's the ticket.
They have a Buzz Flash editorial, and they call Bush the Lord of the Flies.
Pretty much. Read the book.
And he says, basically, George thinks if he piles more dung, something's going to happen. Or something.
Yeah, that a flower's going to blossom out of it.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, it's going to be that big orchid that blooms once every 50 years and smells like a corpse.
Hey, speaking of orchid, for everybody to know, next week on Nature is going to be called, a show on the seedy side of plants, which is the plant invasion takeover, something that we're not paying attention to. See, we thought it was the neocons that are taking over. No, it's the plants.
Well, you know, it always amazes me that the nastiest weed in the world can find its way through asphalt.
Well, it didn't stop Karl Rove, now did it?
Yeah, very well said. Now, Agnes tells me you were on Alan Combs.
No? Yeah, I was on Alan Combs, and I was just basically mentioning that story briefly, what I caught about the radioactive material. He's like, where'd you hear that? And I was like, oh, I heard that on Head On Radio News Network.
Oh, wow. We got a plug?
Yeah.
God bless you, David.
I'm going to be mentioning Head On more. I'm going to find a way to put it in.
Oh, we appreciate it.
Without sounding like a plug or whatever.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, also, just putting the little sand grain in the oyster. Pretty soon you get a pearl.
And also, I think the thing with Al Stewart, this is just an idea, but your thing with Al Stewart and Will Kimbrough, I just thought of a good idea how to promote this network.
How's that?
Just call me Richard Branson or whatever. But you could take a music video of Will Kimbrough or something, and you could take the soundbite of one of your interviews, and you could send it to John Amato of Crooks and Liars.
Oh, very well thought.
And I think, because John Amato's going crazy with the musicians that he's inspired by.
Yeah, the late-night music threads and
right,
stuff.
Right, right. He's really catching on with that. Yeah. And he's really going, like, really hard at it, so I'm thinking, okay, the Al Stewart and the Will Kimbrough.
Well, I tell you what, David, if you'd like to take a run at something like that, if you've got the capabilities, I'd love to see that happen.
I don't know if I have the capabilities to make a clip, but I'm sure someone in your audience does. That's just an idea that I think it would. It's like cross promotion, basically. And I think Amato's pretty good about it because I actually emailed him once, and he put one of my tips up and. He's usually really good and receptive and open and stuff like that.
Well, good deal. We'll try to figure out a way to pull that off.
That's cool.
David, have yourself a great night.
All right, Bob, you too.
Thanks.
Later.
Bye now. Never ceases to amaze me. Ideas out there. You know, this is, I guess it's, we got the smartest audience going. And in a way, I think this might already be trademarked, but this is kind of like open sourcing conversation radio, isn't it? It's an opportunity for people to become actively involved and participants in the process itself. So, to the extent that you can tell your friends, I've been talking the last couple of shows about Rapture Ready real estate and Rapture Ready lawn care and Rapture Ready auto sales and Rapture Ready laundry service. You know, to take advantage of these little goonies who believe, oh, well, you know, it's going to end tomorrow. No, we never know when he's coming back, but boy, it's going to be quick. I mean, he's got to be looking at his watch. I heard from Tosh, one of our longtime listeners, and he said, you know, quit messing around, Bob. You're missing the opportunity. What you want is rapture-ready insurance. Go out there and sell these goonies some insurance. And I got to thinking about it, you know, in the early days of Sputnik. There were insurance companies were at the forefront of it all and jumped right out there to sell credulous Americans insurance policies again that would pay them $1 million if they got hit by a satellite. Wow. Imagine the possibilities. And, you know, I wouldn't feel bad about it at all because, you know, these goobers on the religious right. Well, you know, it's kind of a P.T. Barnum thing, isn't it? And it's a W.C. Fields thing. You know, never smarten up a chump. You can't cheat an honest man. And don't give a sucker an even break. But you can't cheat an honest man. Only the fundamentally dishonest would buy rapture-ready insurance. Come on. All right, break time. Time for a look at what's going on in the world labor news from the Workers' Independent News Service. This is the Head On Radio Network. A little more Al Stewart for you. I'm Bob Kincaid.
At the station underneath the clock, carry an umbrella, no need to talk. The man and the humbug hiding in the fog will be watching. Get yourself a ticket, go through the gate at 7:45 precisely, don't be late. If anybody follows, don't hesitate, keep on walking. And take the night train to Munich, rumbling down the track. After half an hour in the restaurant car, look for the conductor and there will be a stain on his tunic, a paper underneath the sun. Then you gotta pray that he doesn't look away, or you'll never, never, never come back.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
And I'm Jesse Russell. Chaos is in the air as Northwest Airlines flight attendants reject the company's second contract proposal. As soon as the company received word of the rejection, it said it would impose heavier terms as allowed by a bankruptcy court judge. Represented by the Association of Flight Attendants, they fired back, threatening job actions and a potential strike.
The clock is ticking. And August 15th at 9:01 p.m., chaos could arrive at Northwest.
Corey Caldwell is spokesperson for the union. She explained why the union believes the contract was voted down.
The cuts to wages and benefits that the judge had outlined were just too deep. And I think it's something that could resonate with every single person, whether you're in the aviation industry or not. Imagine if you woke up tomorrow and then your company took away 40% of your wages and benefits. It's a huge sacrifice, and one that the flight attendants they can't make.
The Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association has been on strike against the airline for nearly a year. They are scheduled to hold a negotiating session with Northwest on August 15th.
Workers standing shoulder to shoulder is what solidarity is all about. Starbucks should be ashamed of what it's doing.
Industrial Workers of the World Starbucks organizer Daniel Gross. Gross says Starbucks is threatening to fire him for offering mutual aid and support for fired New York City Starbucks union activist Evan Winterscheidt. Gross says Starbucks interrogated him about his union activities, violating a National Labor Relations Board settlement reached in March.
This campaign depends on working people in their communities taking a stand. We need a movement to take on the Walmarts, the Starbucks, and the McDonald's. Together, we can win.
New NLRB charges are being filed against Starbucks. Gross says people who want to support him and the other Starbucks union activists can go to StarbucksUnion.org. Wisconsin's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees is working to defeat a state constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. Wisconsin Ask Me People Conference political director Brian Weeks says such a ban could legally wipe out all domestic partner benefits negotiated by unions.
It attacks workers' rights and attacks labor unions' rights to collectively bargain.
Here's today's economic report. Inflation is at a four-year high, according to the U.S. Commerce Department. Consumer spending is slowing, and the U.S. savings rate has been negative for 15 straight months. It's another sign that working families across the nation are being tapped out by the combination of rising prices, stagnant wages, and an inability to save anything substantial from their paychecks. Another sign of working family economic distress is in housing. There were more contracts to buy homes in the past 2 months, but home sales are down, indicating many of the contracts were canceled. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Tapping one small, elegant shoe in time. Oh, the way she plays with them. Smile at one and dance with another. Pretty soon they're forming up a line. And she's laughing. Laughing into 1939. Oh, laughing. Laughing into 1939.
You know, it occurs to me that, what is it, the Bush tax cuts, the chickens really come home to roost somewhere around 2009, 2010. Maybe we do get to transpose this at some point, because aren't we all just laughing into 2009? Well, some of us aren't. About half of us aren't. More than half of us aren't if you understand that the elections got stolen in 2000 and 2004. It ain't funny. It's 20 minutes before the hour. We're more than halfway through this Tuesday night edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. Your thoughts are indeed more than welcome at 877-443-2366. Email comes roaring in to bob@headonradio.com. And among other things, wow. If you were not able to listen to Dr. Bill O'Brien, who debuted his new program on the Head On Radio Network this afternoon at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, then you missed something. Because I dare say that the level of candor and the level of simple, open honesty. And maybe I shouldn't use the word simple because it's one of the hardest things to come by these days. The open honesty that Dr. Bill brings to this network is to be cherished. And I'll submit to you that in that time slot, you're not going to hear candor like you'll hear from Dr. Bill anywhere on the radio spectrum, right or left. He is that refreshing. He is that candid. And what dedication? A literal dedication to restoring restoring a level of dignity to the political process that's been frankly taken away. Sometimes I am guilty of some of the things that Dr. Bill mentioned today. The cheapening of the political discourse. I'm not that well cultured. I am not that well healed. I'm not over being called a commie and an un-American and for the last 25 years because I believe that working people ought to be able to go to the doctor when they're sick. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know how it is with the right wing. You know, Ann Coulter out there on the day in and day out on Fox with that Adam's apple bobbing along. Yeah, the discourse has been cheapened. I didn't cheapen it. But Dr. Bill is determined to bring civil discourse back to the radio. And today was a great, great start for him. And he'll be there tomorrow and the day after that and the day after that. I hope you will join in. Noon to 2 Eastern Time, 9 to 11 Pacific, right here on the Head On Radio Network, the Dr. Bill O'Brien Show. You will, if you listen and if you call and if you engage this gentleman in conversation, you will come away glad for having done so. Now, back to the business at hand, I'm afraid. And there is plenty of business at hand. Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican, Nebraska, today called for a ceasefire in the Middle East. And that was the lead line to the news story. Maverick Republican. Oh, God, don't Republicans just love it when they get called maverick? It makes them feel, it makes them all tingly and, yeah, feeling all macho. Mako, as a buddy of mine. Oh, they're Mako. The lead line was, you know, Maverick Republican calls for ceasefire, as if, you know, it takes a maverick to call for one country to quit slaughtering the other country's children and vice versa. But he called for an end to the madness. And at the same time, to my way of thinking, they buried the lead, because as I mentioned in our conversation with Al, was it a couple of weeks ago that I began bemoaning the lack of statesmanship, the lack of leadership, not just in the United States, but in the world? And Al, of course, said, well, you know, they're not calling on Peru to end too many of these things, are they? But of course, you know, but Chuck Hagel finally put his finger on it, because when he called for statesmanship, inherent in that call was the fact that George Bush is certainly not providing it. And you see what I mean? Chuck Hagel admitted that George Bush is no leader. Chuck Hagel admitted that George Bush is no statesman. Chuck Hagel admitted that George Bush is incapable of trying to stop the slaughter of the innocents. And why in the world would you expect George Bush to stop the slaughter of the innocents when, in fact, he has been the driving force, the prime mover, if you want to get all Aristotelian about it, in the slaughter of literally tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of innocents in the land between the rivers, in Mesopotamia, in Iraq. Right? Right. So, you know, it's probably a hollow move because, as Bart Kopp noted on his page today, he said, you know, the Republican frontrunners, John McCain, Bush is God. Rudy Giuliani, Bush is God. Bill Frist, Bush is God. Newt Gingrich, Bush is God. Chuck Hagel, stop the madness. Chuck Hagel just stepped out from the Republican pack in doing that. Doesn't mean I'd ever vote for him for president, because I wouldn't. Because he wasn't there, you know, he was all for starting it, but now he wants to stop, he wants a ceasefire in Lebanon, but he hasn't found the guts yet to call for a withdrawal of troops and an end to the war in Iraq. Sorry, you lose, buddy. Next player. But interestingly, on the same day that Chuck Hagel calls for a ceasefire in the Middle East, we get these words. Share them with you. The Middle East is a tinderbox with some key players on all sides waiting for every opportunity to destroy their enemies with bullets, bombs, and missiles. One of the special vulnerabilities of Israel and a repetitive cause of violence is the holding of prisoners. Militant Palestinians and Lebanese know that a captured Israeli soldier or civilian is either a cause of conflict or a valuable bargaining chip for prisoner exchange. This assumption is based on a number of such trades, including 1,150 Arabs, mostly Palestinians, for three Israeli soldiers in 1985. 123 Lebanese for the remains of two Israeli soldiers in 1996. And 433 Palestinians and others for an Israeli businessman and the bodies of three soldiers in 2004. This stratagem precipitated the renewed violence that erupted in June when Palestinians dug a tunnel under the barrier that surrounds Gaza and assaulted some Israeli soldiers, killing two and capturing one. They offered to exchange the soldier for the release of 95 women and 313 children. That would be children. Who were among almost 10,000 Arabs in Israeli prisons. But this time Israel rejected a swap and attacked Gaza in an attempt to free the soldier and stop rocket fire into Israel. The resulting destruction brought reconciliation between warring Palestinian factions and support for them throughout the Arab world. Hezbollah militants then killed three Israeli soldiers and captured two others and insisted on Israel's withdrawal from disputed territory and in exchange for some of the several thousand incarcerated Lebanese. With American backing, Israeli bombs and missiles rained down on Lebanon, Hezbollah rockets from Syria, and Iran struck northern Israel. It is inarguable that Israel has a right to defend itself against attacks on its citizens. But it is inhumane and counterproductive to punish civilian populations in the illogical hope that somehow they will blame Hamas and Hezbollah for provoking the devastating response. The result, instead, has been that broad Arab and worldwide support has been rallied for these groups, while condemnation of both Israel and the United States has intensified. How about that? I didn't write that. No. I can't write sentences that long. No, that was written by a statesman. That was written by a leader. That was written by a man whom history will judge far more kindly than this pusillanimous little cowboy from Crawford. I know, Texans, stand down, Texans. No need to run for the borders. No need to come after Bob. I know he's not a Texan. And the Connecticut people don't want him either. But you see the difference? The sound bites from Dear Leader's little trip to Miami. We went to the restaurant with some football players and we got the crabs. Yeah, he said it. I'm just quoting. And then you see that. Could George Bush write a single sentence in the paragraphs that I just read to you? No. Not a prayer. Not a chance. That old saw about infinite monkeys with infinite typewriters, and one of them will eventually write Hamlet? Infinite Bushes with infinite typewriters could not write a word of what I just wrote, what I just read to you. So Chuck Hagel, senator from Nebraska, calls for a leader today, acknowledges the world's outcry, the world's grieving, the world's weeping, wailing call for leadership in this bleeding little planet. And contemporaneously in the pages of the Washington Post comes commentary from just such a leader, from just such a statesman. The words I read you are the words of one Jimmy Carter. And, of course, the right-wing freaks like Hannity, Savage, Beck, Flemball, giggle away every time the word Jimmy Carter is spoken. Well, don't you remember that his inflation? I happen to remember that his inflation started before his presidency. I happen to recall that his inflation started in the Nixon administration. Yeah, troublesome, isn't it, Republicans? Let's go to the phones. Michael Savage is on line two.
Hey, Bob, how you doing there?
Is that you, Mr. Savage?
It's me, Bob, and I got the whole lowdown on the Mel Gibson thing here for you. You know, if you and your listeners can handle it.
I think we can handle it. I'm not so sure if it's you we can handle.
Well, see,
I mean, my dinner's on the way up already, Mr. Savage.
Yeah, you just watch it there, Bob. The reason they pulled over Mel Gibson, he had just flashed himself to Jeff Gannon. Gannon got on his cell, warned the police, you know.
Mel Gibson exposed himself to Jeff Gannon?
Yeah, it was a mistaken identity. He thought it was a Bruce Willis that was a little overweight there. Yeah, I was reading Pravda, you know, that commie newspaper people like you read.
Not all the time. I've got two subscriptions.
Yeah, the retirement home being built for Holocaust victims. by the company that built Hitler's bunker.
What?
I wish I wasn't making that up.
I know, I wish you weren't. A retirement home for Holocaust victims is being built by the same company that, yes, indeedy,
built the bunker. A Czech branch of Hochtief, H-O-C-H-T-I-E-F, Germany's largest construction company, started building an $8.89 million retirement home last month and plans to complete it within 18 months.
Well, you know, we got Nazis in the Vatican. Yeah, we got a Nazi pope. Why not let? Yeah, God.
Oh, yeah.
You know, my,
well, we're gonna do it.
The same people built the German 88 that made my coffee maker. You know, Krupp.
Yeah, we're gonna send Lance Bass to the Middle East. Maybe he can, you know, work out a settlement.
Maybe.
Chris Matthews had Adam's apple on his show the other day.
Adam's apple, Annie?
Oh, boy, yeah. Oh, don't get me started. And he was mentioning something. She wrote in a book about swarthy. And she would not go, oh, you're just going to on that one word, on that one thing. Yeah, you're not going to talk about any of the rest of my book. You know, it's one thing to attack Republicans for supporting Bush and Dick Cheney. This is a man who TNA is terror and atrocity.
Yeah. Oh, good one.
Yeah.
Is that your own?
That's my own.
Bravo, Chris.
I thought it up while I'm...
This is our buddy Chris from Florence, Alabama.
While I was on hold, I thought that one up. But I was looking around the different links, and Jim was it, and y'all were talking about Hitler. And so I click on Pravda, and a retirement home for Holocaust victims. Built in Prague. Okay, that's... In itself, I thought, well, a retirement home for Holocaust victims. No, we need those. La, 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 la. Same place Hitler... Oh, boy.
Well, at least they're not building it on the bunker. Are they?
No. My goodness. But, you know, it's easy to attack people that like Bush. But the people that want to back up, stand there and back up and support Ann Coulter.
Well, they're few and far between. News, but even conservative papers are dropping her now. I mean, what at the point where she up and admitted that she sent the envelope full of white powder, you know, cornstarch, to the New York Times. You know, I think it began. I think, you know, it's kind of Churchillian at that point. This may not be the beginning of the end, but it's the end of the beginning. You know, she's on the way out the door.
Oh my goodness! I mean, I.
Well, what was it? One of Reagan's deputy communications directors or something had a column in the paper a couple of weeks ago in the Sunday paper around here it was carried, and he said, you know, Ann Coulter doesn't speak for me. Yeah, because they're trying to distance themselves from her because it's an election year. Now, you let the election end. Oh, I'd say by November the 30th, she's going to be speaking for him again.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
This is the lipstick on a pig phase of Republican politics.
Oh God, you're so kind.
Who, to the Republicans or the pigs?
Ooh, don't throw my pearls at swine. Both.
Or little black dresses, either. I know.
Yeah. Did you? I don't know those rumors that the last two times I posted on Mansell Report. The rumors. I didn't know if I could use them on the air, so I just wrote them down and posted them.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little dicey.
Some
a little dicey.
Some of them, yeah. Some of them, especially the Condi Rice piece.
Well, you know, we don't even have to make stuff up about her anymore.
No. The Bush thing. Voted. Could that one, about the pretzel?
Yeah.
Could I do that one?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And Bush, in his high school yearbook, was voted most likely to go down on something. We just didn't know it would be a pretzel. We knew it was a salty treat, but we didn't know it would be a pretzel.
Oh, thank God this is the Internet.
But I can do, can I do one last one? Can one I do one about Joe Lieberman?
All right.
When I recently saw Bill Clinton speaking on behalf of Joe Lieberman, it hit me. The only way Lieberman can win the nomination is if every pedestal pollster in Connecticut starts driving a hybrid.
Oh, Chris, you're a
hybrid. Okay,
you're a twisted man. Hey, a little trivia thing for you. I got to sit back and watch a couple of films over the weekend, And one of the films that I watched was The Libertine.
I haven't got to see
with
that.
Johnny Depp and John Malkovich. Brilliant film. And at the end, and I'm not giving anything away, but in the closing credits, the last thing on the closing credits, dedicated to the memory of Marlon Brando and Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, Johnny is going to play Hunter again in The Rum Diary.
Oh, that should be fun.
Yeah, the young man that starred in Black Hawk Down, I can't never think of his name, he was talked about at first, but Johnny Depp's going to play him.
Johnny Depp could play in a toothpaste commercial, and my lovely wife would try to nominate him for an Academy Award.
So would my lovely wife, yeah.
He has that power.
I haven't been calling your show for a while, as we've talked about an email. I've just been so depressed.
It's easy to be that way.
But I have read Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 1972 about four times here lately. And it gives me goosebumps, like you've said before to other listeners. It is what's going on now. It is.
It bears rereading. I was walking through the house just the other evening, and I looked at Agnes, and I said, and I find myself saying this a lot, damn, I miss Hunter Thompson.
I tell you, honestly, it brings me to tears when I think about it. I just miss him so much. I've been reading him my entire life,
mm-hmm.
just about. I was exposed to Rolling Stone very early, and there's just hardly anybody that you can point to that has, whether outlandish or not, that has been so on the mark.
Yeah.
Everybody that, what's that, David, Joe Mankiewicz, McGovern's campaign manager, said that Fear and Loathing on Campaign Trail was the most factual and least factual book on that campaign.
Absolutely.
Everybody, you know, well, he wrote this outlandish style, but nobody got the stories that he did or was on. So
the only for my money, Chris, the only person who is even remotely coming close these days is probably Mark Morford out at the San Francisco Chronicle.
I'm going to have to read him.
Mark Morford's a genius, and you know, of
Mark Moore.
Morford, M-O-R-F-O-R-D. Chris, we got to hit the news.
Well,
it's so good to hear from you. Hang in there. Don't let this stuff get you down.
It's the Middle East. It's the Middle East.
I know, but if nothing else, try to find time to tune in, because, you know, this is a little sandbox.
Oh, I know.
And if nothing else, we can lift ourselves up out of the depths of the despair just by realizing that there are others who feel the same way.
Absolutely. Take care, Bob.
Take care and stay out of the heat, because I know it's got to be warm where you are.
You couldn't cook an egg, but you could boil a green bean.
Sounds good.
All right.
Later.
Bye.
Bye. Our good friend Chris, mansellreport.blogspot.com. And it's going to be bumper music or not bumper music? Or... Yes, Agnes? That'll work. Okay, news time. We're a little bit over the top of the hour. We'll get there. This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid.
This is the Quality News Network. Israeli troops are reportedly inside a hospital in eastern Lebanon fighting Hezbollah guerrillas armed with rifles and grenades. In other violence today, Israeli aircraft hit several sites near the Syrian border while troops continued moving deeper into Lebanon.
In Cuba, a state-run television station read a statement by Cuban President Fidel Castro that says he's fine after undergoing surgery. He has temporarily ceded power to his younger brother, 75-year-old Raul, while he recuperates. In Washington, Democratic leaders in both the House and Senate are calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq by the end of the year. That comes as 70 more people, including an American and a British soldier, were killed in fighting today. In Iraq, the son of Montana Senator Max Baucus was killed in fighting over the weekend. The Department of Defense said the 28-year-old Marine died Saturday during combat operations in Anbar province. In 2002, Senator Baucus voted to authorize war in Iraq. In southern Afghanistan, at least two British NATO soldiers were killed today in an ambush. Yesterday, NATO took over control of the area from U.S.-led coalition forces. NATO will take over control of eastern Afghanistan later this year. In Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has officially rejected the resolution issued by the UN Security Council yesterday. It demands that Tehran abandon its nuclear program by August 31st or face possible sanctions. A tropical storm watch has been issued for Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the British Virgin Islands as Tropical Storm Chris gathers strength. The U.S. National Hurricane Center says it could become a small hurricane within 3 days. In Washington today, the Senate voted to open more than 8 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico to oil and gas drilling, but the measure still has to be reconciled with another measure passed by the House in June. In southeastern Florida, the state has purchased about 115 square miles of wilderness for environmental conservation. Conservationists are praising the $350 million deal. In the West, fire crews are battling almost 60 major wildfires that are burning out of control. For the first time in 3 years, federal land management agencies have put employees on standby status. And temperatures today are expected to top 100 degrees in many parts of the East Coast. The heat wave is expected to last 3 days. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning doctor...
Great price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to RightCarRightPrice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to RightCarRightPrice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
Northwest Airlines flight attendants are threatening to conduct random strikes starting August 15th unless the airline makes concessions in a disputed labor contract. Yesterday, the flight attendants voted down a contract that would have cut their pay and benefits by more than 20%. The Federal Reserve will meet next week to decide whether to raise interest rates again to protect against inflation. The Commerce Department reports weak consumer spending in June for the fourth month in a row, but construction spending reached a higher rate, mostly due to government contracting. Toyota sales passed Ford's last month for the first time. The company credits high gas prices for the boost in sales. Honda also reported strong sales. General Motors has restated its second quarter net loss, increasing it by $200 million. That's to account for the sale of its finance arm, GMAC, which is now not expected to close in the fourth quarter. Eastman Kodak has posted a second quarter net loss of $282 million. The company is also eliminating another 2,000 jobs. Sirius Satellite Radio is also reporting a $238 million loss for its second quarter as the company continues to build its subscriber base. Light sweet crude settled at $74.91 today. At the close of Wall Street, the Dow was down 60 points at 11,126. NASDAQ down 29. S&P 500 down 6. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kim.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366.
Here's Buck.
So there's a few things out there that I'd like for us to touch on. Something happened in the Friday news dump, you know, the stuff that comes roaring out of the White House about 4:30 in the afternoon after the crack White House press corps has already got their first hit of acid down, their first main line of heroin in their veins, and, you know, the first few glasses of, Chateau L'Amour. And that was, just sort of out there, and not a peep. Not a blessed word have I heard. And, you know, I pay attention to that. Maybe I'm just reading the wrong sites. But the White House has proposed some legislation and sent it to Congress. Hearings will begin in September. What legislation? Why, it's legislation that defines and gives permission to the president to himself define what an enemy combatant is, and gives him power to indefinitely detain people in his secret prisons without recourse to habeas corpus. You know, something that's been pretty central to all Anglo-American jurisprudence since, 14th century? Runnymede? Magna Carta? This is the response to the Hamdan case. This is the legislation that Arlen Specter said, well, you know, maybe we need to just make it legal for the president to do all these things since the Supreme Court said it's not.
No, it's not.
Here it comes. I wanted to mention this to you. I don't even have the story in front of me. But the proposed legislation has been sent to the Congress. Now, you want a list? I can give you a list of Democrats that I predict will not have the guts to filibuster it or to oppose it. Joe Lieberman. Robert Byrd. Mary Landrieu. Ben Nelson. Bill Nelson. Come on. Debbie Stabenow. Come on, there are more. You know there are more. And how about those moderate swing Republicans? Hey, there's swinging Republicans. What hepcats? Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, Lincoln Chafee. I would almost predict it. Blanche Lincoln, David Pryor, Arkansas. Won't have the guts to stand up to him. Dianne Feinstein won't have the guts to stand up to it. Sometime around late September, you heard it here first, a bill will go to the president's desk for his signature, because Democrats would not stand up against it, that will grant carte blanche powers to George W. Bush to imprison anyone he wishes. Don't take my word for it. It is there in black and white. You can do the search for yourself. The news stories hit Friday evening, and gone. I don't whistle very well, sorry. Poof. How's that? Because, of course, you know, over the weekend, Mel Gibson got snockered on 3 shots of tequila and started proving that the apple falleth not far from the tree, and that he was, in fact, his father's son. You know, his daddy, who moved to West Virginia, who lives about 20 miles from me, Hutton Gibson, who said he was moving to West Virginia because there weren't any Jews there. The officer who arrested him was, I believe, in fact, Jewish, and Mel asked him, "Yeah, Jewish are you? You know, Jews caused all the wars in the world." Arr. You know, his planned miniseries on the Holocaust for ABC Disney, Disney ABC, whatever you want to call it, was canceled today. And, you know, it would have been, I think it would have been a challenge for Mel to shoot that, you know, all those scenes of those millions of Jews committing suicide in the Holocaust. Because Mel doesn't even believe it existed. Neither does his daddy. You know, I mean, we're talking about the real, get them nutcases. You know, Hutton Gibson, Mel's daddy, said that it was the Jews who brought down the towers on 9/11. Yeesh. So, you know, we didn't see what just happened to me. It's easy to talk about this stuff. But that's what happens. Oh, well, you know, we got to talk about Mel Gibson. Can't talk about the fact that the president has been proposed that he have the power of life and death over any human being that he chooses on this planet. Can't talk about that. Too complicated. Go look it up. Go read it. George Bush, under this legislation, will have the power to define enemy combatant as he sees fit and order the arrest of any human being on planet Earth and the imprisonment of said human being without recourse to the courts. He will then be able to order them tried by a kangaroo court of his appointment and have them executed by executioners of his choosing. And if you missed it, all that business about, well, you know, someday I'd like to close down Guantanamo. I don't believe it's feasible at this time, but someday I hope we can close down Guantanamo. Construction's been begun on a brand new permanent prison facility at Guantanamo. Of course Bush was lying. It's what he does. He breathes, he lies. He lies, he breathes. So go and have a look. Look for yourself. Tell me if I'm wrong. If I am, you know, I'll freely admit it. But I read the story. I went and I looked at the legislation. That's what it looks like to me. Ever wonder why those Homeland Security prisons are being built all across the United States that they even admit to? That millions and millions of dollars are being poured into, and who's the contractor? That's right, Halliburton, you remember? Paying attention is tough. You know, our good friend Chris from Alabama mentioned that, you know, he's just been besieged in a depressive funk. It's easy to have happen. I'm struggling with it, quite honestly. Day in and day out of just... And frankly, it's not because I'm doing this program. It's because I am actively engaged in trying to be civically responsible and follow what's going on in my government, and everything going on in my government right now is bad. So I encourage you, if you know other people who are who follow current events and who follow the news and who need an outlet to discuss what's going on, by all means, tell them about this program, because this program and the programs on the Head On Radio Network, Bruce Birch, Guy James, Mark Levine, Dr. Bill O'Brien, all present opportunities for legitimate conversation with the extraordinary Americans who carry this nation upon their backs. And it is something that does not happen very much anywhere else. Dr. Bill did a lovely job of trying to define the difference between conversation and talk and dialogue. And he, like I said, he did a magnificent job doing it. If you didn't get to hear it today, go to the archives. Dr. Bill's archives are right there at the White Rose Society, just like mine are. Check it out. You will be glad. And then... share your time with us. Let us share our time with you. And let us commiserate. And let us seek common cause and seek hope for the day when the word president doesn't have to be followed by the word Bush. Let's go to the phones. David is calling from Middle Tennessee. David, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Bob.
How are you?
I'm doing quite well. It's hot here like it is everywhere.
Yes, we're broadcasting live from the Head On Radio Network saunas this evening.
Oh, I'm sure. And what a courageous fellow you are. You mentioned informed discourse and real conversation, and then you bring me on. Boy, you are one more courageous guy.
Well, it fits, man. It fits.
But I haven't been able to listen all night, but potentially the first real crackpot conspiracy theory that, you know, maybe not a conspiracy theory. There's only one reason in my mind that George Bush is doing some of the things that he's doing, like that little 4:30, 4:45 on a Friday. Here's my little suggestion on how to imprison anybody that looks at me funny and execute them. And, oh, by the way, nobody's saying anything. The only reason I think he's doing that is he does not intend to relinquish the presidency of the United States.
There are nights that I have nightmares about that, David.
And I'm jokingly, just to keep from going crazier, I'm jokingly saying I'm dealing in conspiracy theory, but what president in his right mind 2 years and 6 months before leaving office would want to do anything to perpetuate a Guantanamo? Why wouldn't you want that all tidied up? You know, it comes.
Well, I can give you a plausible excuse if this isn't a rhetorical question.
Let her fly.
George Bush, and this was manifested in Doonesbury recently. George Bush is not out to make a legacy. There is, you know, maybe we ascribe too much to Karl Rove, David. Sometimes I think we do. Sometimes I think we don't ascribe enough. George Bush knows he has no legacy. George Bush doesn't care about a legacy. George Bush is whacked out of his mind on something. I saw where comedian Will Durst put up this parody piece where he says that he's interviewed a Johns Hopkins psychiatrist who has diagnosed Bush remotely and is convinced that George Bush is in third stage syphilis. But, you know, be that as it may, George doesn't, for whatever reason, George doesn't care about a legacy. George doesn't care about the future. You know, we're not going to have a future. We're all going to be dead. We know he said that. What George, and like I said, I think it's mostly Rove, what they're concerned with, they know. I think they know pretty damn well, and it may be because they intend to manipulate the voting machines this way, they know pretty damn well that a Republican is not going to get into the White House in 2008. Frankly, the way that they have treated John McCain, I think they imagine he will be the presumptive nominee, and they're waiting for one last chance, David, to get the shiv between his ribs and give it a really good twist. And that being the case, they're trying to make as big a mess. You know, remember when they put out that phony, bogus, dummied-up, ginned-up, stupid little story about how Bill Clinton stole all the W's on the computer keyboards before he left? Remember that?
Oh, yes.
Well, see, these slugs really mean to do something like that, only on a much grander scale. By the time George leaves in January of 2009, Iraq will be in a full-blown conflagration. We will be at possibly 7,000 American dead and 50,000 crippled. The misery in Iraq and Lebanon will still be going on. We will have had two or three more Katrinas by then. Maybe even a couple more terrorist attacks. Who knows if you've been a terrorist schmerist. And this is going to be the great big plate of caca that Carl is going to hand to a Democrat, thinking that there'll be 4 years of that president. It'll be an absolute failure, and in 2012, the United States will welcome Jeb Bush as an avenging savior. I'm trying to play chess here, David. I'm tired
of... I can't say that I disagree, because they're trying to do something that, to me, you know, it's like not cleaning up when you have that kegger when you're in high school while mom and dad are away. You know, like just not cleaning up at all. I was thinking more short term, you know. George's prison. Somebody is going to have to open those doors and man by man, woman by woman, look at those people around the world and do something with them. But, you know, and I'm thinking, well, God, that's like the biggest nightmarish black eye I could ever imagine. So what you're saying, you know, that could be the reason. Plus, January, the, what would it be, the 15th or the 18th or the 21st, whenever?
21st.
Whenever the sacrificial Democrat, according to your theory, is inaugurated, within 48 hours, everything that's going wrong, the Rove crap spreader will have it blamed on A, Bill Clinton, and B, the current Democratic president.
Exactly.
So then, from the rooftops, from the megaphones, from the flimbulb, you know, sound creation machine, he'll be spitting it out. They'll all be spitting it out. The horrors of the Democratic president.
Well, and not only that, they also know that no one occupying the no one occupying the White House, with the exception of George Bush, because he is such a mental midget. I heard my good friend Mike Malloy refer to him last night down in Miami as the guacamoron. Man, there's some precious, you know, raisin brain. Mike's got
I like
it.
That.
Yeah. No one with the exception of George Bush can sit in the Oval Office and whine and get away with it. And so the next occupant of the White House will not be allowed to whine about the mess that he or she has been handed.
Agreed. And they will make it a nightmare. And the other thing that I think spurs them on, and this is George, and this is Wolf Fitz, and all the rest of them, they believe that to create chaos in the Middle East will stir the pot in some way, out of which will come a new Middle East.
And oh, they're going to get a new Middle East, all right.
Oh, yeah, they're working really hard on that. Boy, Ms. Rice can be even more condescending about, oh, a few casualties, and Israel should be accountable in these areas, but they must be able to defend themselves. Wink, wink. No.
Well, you know, maybe we can trot out that old beast, Barbara Bush, and she can talk about why does she want to see the dead Lebanese children with her beautiful mind. That's the only thing that hasn't happened yet.
They're probably going to keep her under wraps for the most part.
Well, or...
But that is terribly scary that just...
They're keeping their bushel under a light.
Oh. Boom. That a boy, Bob.
Thank you. I got a million. But
that, now then, you've scared me. Now then, my little conspiracy theory about George simply declaring martial law and saying, I'm not leaving. The job's not done. There's hard work to do.
Oh, I think that... No, David, don't get me wrong. I think that contingency is out there as well. If they can get their wish, you know, just like the Project for a New American Century people wrote in their ugly little manifesto, if they can get a Pearl Harbor, they can keep George Bush in there until his brain absolutely rots down to the last neuron.
I've never seen a president that was so all over the ballpark, just all over the map. Pardon the mixed metaphors, but... I've never seen a guy that was so erratic in his personal presentation of ideas. There are times, I think, when they get his dosages right, and he reads the script, and he speaks in sentences, and he's got a completely different accent. For all I know, there may be two or three, you know, Bush bodies out there, and they just activate the, you know, a different one in different circumstances. But he can stand occasionally and not do a terrible job of a speech. And then he can be someplace where possibly it's not a scripted event, and it is the most disjointed in a completely different speaking voice, completely different accent. It's almost as if it's two different.
You've got to hear the Miami audio from yesterday. I don't have it handy. But you have got to hear it, David. Maybe the fine folks at WSpeak.com have picked it up by now.
I have seen some of it, and it's scary.
I want to say hello to La Costa Garda. Really?
Ugh.
La Costa Garda.
Oh, and of course the other big story that the news is beating to death that doesn't really matter.
Mel?
Well, no, besides Mel. You know, whether or not Fidel's Bowery section is successful.
Oh, I know. Oh, thank you for opening that door, David. Because
and then you got Jebby down there with the, I've got a plan to make sure we're not overrun with freedom-loving people from Cuba. He can't let 50,000 people that live in his state that pay his salary vote, but he's got it figured out on how to protect everybody else from, you know, canoe paddling Cubans.
Well, there's another part of that too. Heard in one of the QNN reports, David, they said the State Department says that they cannot confirm that he's not dead or is dead.
Francisco Franco's valiant efforts to remain dead.
Yeah.
Same sort of double talk.
And I'm thinking, you know, but we get really, really chapped if Hugo Chavez says we are unable to confirm whether or not George W. Bush is suffering from end stage syphilis.
Hmm.
You know, what a double standard there is in this world. You know, the story's out there. It was in the Washington Post today about the State Department's contingency plans to move in immediately and support the democracy movement in Cuba.
Oh, great! That's gonna be. Oh, you think we just think we were welcomed with chocolates and flowers when we got to Baghdad? Wait till some big American flags start rolling into Havana. That'll work.
And was it Hearst or Pulitzer? I can't remember which, who said, "You give me the pictures, I'll give you the war." About Cuba.
That's much more like the Hearst family, I think. Or no, for the Cuban War, that might have been Pulitzer. Either guy could have said that.
Well, I tell you, that's a story that doesn't deserve reporting. Oh, he temporarily handed over power. Well, you know, geez, Ronald Reagan temporarily handed over power when he was getting polyps taken out of his rotten old colon. So what?
Exactly. I mean, you're going to be under anesthesia, and you're 79 years old. You're 2 weeks away from 80. You know, that's page 6 of the President's Manual. If you're going to be knocked out by an anesthesiologist, you should turn over the reins of power if you're, you know, over the age of 60. Anybody can react badly to anesthesia.
Yeah.
Ask the good nurse in the house.
Well, she knows.
It's a very trying time, and it's really scary. And now that you've got just a herd of rollover. There's some aspects of the Democratic Party. You know, there might be more resistance out of the Republicans than some of those Democrats about this rewrite the rules now. You know, never mind the Geneva Convention, all the rest of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, what was it? Was it today, yesterday, a group of 10 Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, they wrote a letter to President Bush. I'm wondering if they got the really thick first grade art paper with the crayons, you know, and Nancy. I want the green one. They wrote a letter to President Bush.
So they'll know you're mad.
Yes. And they wrote a letter to President Bush saying, "We call upon you to begin a troop withdrawal plan from Iraq by the end of the year." Still ain't got it. They still have not figured it out.
Well, getting back, I just thought of something. Getting back to that bill about Bush and his unlimited powers.
Yeah.
You reckon maybe Leave the Feed is going to co-sponsor it with some Republicans so he can get kissed again?
It would not surprise me in the least. I mean, that man is not, he's not operating on the same planet or breathing the same essential gases as you and me.
I heard about a 40-minute interview between a frontline Democrat in Connecticut, a writer for the New York Times, and whatever the current ranking guy is for the, what's the hideous, you know, compromise at all cost Democratic Party functioning committee, whatever.
The DLC?
The DLC. And this guy kept saying over and over and over. Well, the DLC guy kept saying, well, now, all of you people out there need to understand that Senator Lieberman has voted with the Democratic Party some, you know, insanely high 96-98% of the vote. Well, I'm sorry. Not fighting that war you know, there's signing on and sticking with and supporting George Bush for the war in Iraq. There's that one thing. I don't care how many water bills he voted for that all the other Democrats voted for. I don't care about that. What I care about is he wouldn't fight the Supreme Court nominee by pushing filibuster. Of course, then when it didn't matter, he turned around and voted as a Democrat really should have. If he should have voted that way the first time. He should have been part of a filibuster, but he should have been. But this business that, oh, well, he's voted 90-some-odd percent, but if you are doing that much to perpetuate that war, you do not deserve the tag of a member of the Democratic Party. It's just, it's unconscionable.
It is indeed.
And it's like break time to me by my little clock on the wall.
Well, dadgummit. I get so flustered, and I appreciate, David, I appreciate you taking me all these different places and allowing me to pontificate, I guess. I'm sorry I stepped on your dime so much. But
you were fine by me.
No, you're absolutely right. There was I saw an interview with or footage of Lieberman where, you know, man on the street kind of thing, and he goes up and he greets the voter. Hi, how you doing? I'm Joe Lieberman. And the guy goes, I think I'm doing better than you, Joe.
Way to go, average citizen. Well, he'd gotten pretty fat. He'd gotten really comfortable, and he had distanced himself. And he just thought, I'm who I am, and I'm above it all. And he thought, breeze through primary. The Republicans got financial issues that, I mean, even the Republican Party is trying to get their own candidate to pull out of the race so that they don't have to deal with his financial dirty laundry. So he just thought, well, you know, I'm who I am, and I was nominated to be the vice president, and I'm Joe Lieberman, and you're not, therefore I don't have to worry about it. Well, gee whiz, enough people in that state care about that hideous war and what all the other things, not that the war's not bad enough, but it's a double-edged sword. All the things that the war prevent us from paying attention to and applying resource to. We don't have the time and we don't have the resource because of W's little war.
Simple, isn't it? Amazing how hard it is to comprehend for a Bushista.
Oh, boy. Well, they keep reading those neocon position papers and acting on them.
And taking the brown acid.
Taking the brown acid.
David,
Bob, thanks
so much.
Thanks again for the chance.
My pleasure. Have a great evening.
I shall. Talk to you later.
Bye now. Don't eat the brown acid. Carl Rove missed that one. Let's take a break. When we come back, a couple more stories just to sort of tie things together. We don't connect dots, we tie knots. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.
On a morning from a forgot movie, in a country where they turn back time, you go strolling through the crowd like Peter Lorre contemplating a crime. She comes out. Don't bother asking for an explanation. She'll just tell you that she came in the year of the cat. She doesn't give you time for questions as she locks up your eyes. Which direction completely disappears? By the blue tiled walls near the market stalls, there's a hidden door she leads you to. These days, she says, I feel my life just like a river running through the year of the cat.
Yeah. Are you still looking for weapons of mass destruction? Concerned about the future of the Supreme Court? You want to know how government bureaucrats are changing Social Security, overtime pay, or the environment? Maybe you just want to know if the president's lying to you, or when our troops in Iraq can finally come home. I'm Mark Levine. I've got the inside scoop. When you want to know what's going on inside the Beltway, you need a Beltway insider. Someone who's worked in the government and still has sources willing to give you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. So for lively debate, reasoned opinion, detailed analysis of history and policy, or just a point of view you don't hear expressed in the mainstream media, tune in to the Inside Scoop. Feel free to call in too. Agree or disagree. All opinions are welcome. It just might make you think. That's the Inside Scoop, weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, 1 Central, 11 o'clock Pacific, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Bruce Burt's radio program, weekdays, 5 to 7 p.m., connecting people.
Listen, oh, we have the founding fathers and mothers, and we got the founding sisters. Don't forget about that.
It's Wicked Witch of the North, huh, Peter?
Jim, I'm the Wicked Witch of the South. Glad to meet you, buddy.
Well, listen, I sent an email. You haven't replied.
Dude, I replied to your email. I told you that we wanted to have you in chat.
I can't do it. They won't let me in.
Oh, please.
Is this a good idea?
You're a real, both of you are total cap.
Bruce, I love you more.
Uh-oh.
Oh, my God. Oh, I'm going to have to retreat to my Barbara Cartland novels and my box of bonbons.
Oh, God, the world's worst bitch fight on internet radio. This is great.
This is great. So, do I have to flip a coin, or what's the deal here?
Don't miss Bruce Burch, weekdays, 5 to 7 p.m. on the Head On Radio Network.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Before the hour. This evening has flown by. I want to continue with a theme, if I may, for a moment, please, because, like I said, our good friend Bart Kopp, he says, you know, if the Democrats would hire him, he could teach them how to fight and quit losing elections, and I think half the time he's probably right. Or more than half the time. But that's a little bit of what I'm trying to do, too, and what I was trying to do in laying out that scenario for David. It's not about a legacy. It's about these people don't do legacies. These Republicans don't do legacies. They do mess. They do chaos. because out of chaos comes the opportunity to make more money. Politics, schmolitics. Statesmen, schmatesmen. Baby, for these people, the game is money. And to that end, it is the opportunity to make money out of chaos that motivates them. And, of course, there's a little soupçon of just political skullduggery. I forget who it was. Was it Jeb Stuart Magruder or one of those low-rent Watergate thugs who, maybe it was Howard Hunt, one of those upper-level Watergate thugs, who coined the term for what they did to their Democratic opponents. And I'm not going to say the word. Don't worry. You don't have to reach for the button, Agnes. But rat F. Rat pluck. You get the idea. That's what they called it. Rat. And it's what the Bushevics, the Bushistas, it's what they specialize in.
Pluck 'em.
What was that? What was that, George?
Pluck 'em.
Yeah, pluck 'em. They do. They specialize in it. And everything that's being set up is being set up in anticipation of what happens on January 21st, 2009. And that is going to be, and they're giggling about it right now. I am, like I said to David, I'm trying to play chess. I'm trying to get out of this Democratic checkers mentality. You know, this mentality that says, well, if we just don't move any checkers, you know, like, some they'll come to us and we'll get to jump them all because we're good checker players. You know, that's what this is. That not being proactive, not being on the attack, not driving the nails home. Into the heart, nails, stakes, not driving the wooden stakes through the filthy vampiric heart of the Republican Party is kind of where a bunch of Democrats are.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
Yeah, thanks, George. Only thing is, we're afraid to come on. And so it's all laid out. The Republican Party has already decided that they're going to pick our nominee for us in the Democratic Party. They're going to choose our nominee for us just like they chose John Kerry. And they know who they're going to choose because they already have a cottage industry entirely built up around destroying her. And even, I would submit, even in this poison pill, incredibly politically cynical, dirty little bill that the Republican House sent over to the Senate regarding the minimum wage. Even in that are the seeds of what they hope will be the destruction of Hillary Clinton.
So I hear the voices, but I'm the decider.
Yes, George, we know. Now go to bed. Get your footy pajamas on and go to bed.
Pluck 'em.
So, Hillary, I mean, you'll notice this started in the House of Representatives. And as the House went on vacation, they shipped this noxious little piece of garbage over to the Senate for its consideration. Now, what has it got? It's got everything the Republicans could possibly want in terms of something with which to flay the skin off of Hillary Clinton. You might as well call this the Hillary Bill. I don't know if anybody else is mentioning this. I don't know if this has dawned on anyone else. But I'm telling you, this is what it was designed for. The Republican Party has decided that they are going to run either Rudy Giuliani or John McCain or you know, some Republican to be named later against Hillary Clinton in the 2008 presidential election. And progressives and liberals and the rest of the Democratic Party can go hang because Hillary is going to be the nominee. Because they have declared it, just as they declared that it would be John Kerry. All right. By the way, where's Bill Bradley? I heard the other day, he turned 62 years old. He just disappeared after he ran against Al Gore. Where's Bill Bradley? Might be nice to hear from Bill Bradley before 2008. But anyway, look at the minimum wage bill. It's an amusement park fun ride for the Republican Party. Because when they send it over to the Senate, if Hillary votes against it, as she should, because, frankly, giving the working poor a $2 an hour raise in exchange for a $10,000 or $100,000 or $1 million tax break for Paris Hilton is noxious in the extreme, and no Democrat worth his salt should have anything to do with it. If Hillary votes against it, then the repigs get to run. Hillary hates working people! And, of course, you know, a lot of people on my side will go, yeah, she does! Because she may very well. Where was she when the New York Transit Authority workers went on strike? Nowhere to be found. Couldn't stand with those working people. But never mind. So, you know, the repigs are counting on us in the liberal left or progressives or whatever they're, you know, well, they call us commies and anarchists and that kind of thing. But they're counting on us to say, you know, Hillary wouldn't vote for working people. While at the same time, they mount the other side of the pincer assault and say, Hillary's another one of them tax-soaked the rich Democrats. She don't understand that it's the rich people what drives America and creates jobs. Of course, I'm an excellent driver, drives low on the driveway. Do you see? She's damned if she does, and she's damned if she doesn't. And the same thing applies to any member of the United States Senate who happens to be a Democrat and has presidential aspirations, Joe Biden, Russ Feingold. But this is aimed directly at Hillary. Just like those little children in Israel were writing messages on the artillery shells that were being sent into apartment complexes in Lebanon, this bill had, with love, John Boehner to Hillary, written all over it. You know, this is the old LBJ thing from back in his congressional days when he was trailing his opponent and told, you know, perhaps it's apocryphal, but he told his campaign manager to put it out in the press that LBJ wanted to know if his opponent had stopped having sex with farm animals. And his campaign manager looked at him and said, LBJ, I can't put something out there like that. There ain't a lick of truth in it. And LBJ just grinned. He said, I know. I just want to hear him deny it. This is that. This is that very same thing for Hillary Clinton. You watch. A whole bunch of everything that goes down is aimed at Hillary Clinton because they are hell-bent on choosing her for us. We don't get to vote on the stupid stinking machines, and we don't, and even if we vote on the stupid stinking machines, we don't get to choose from a real field of candidates. Because the Republican Party and the DLC, you know, who sup at the same corporate trough, have decided that, you know, the unwashed, us, the hoi polloi, what business have we trying to select the leadership of the United States? The Washington Post, in their editorial page today, said, unrelenting in their zeal to cut taxes for the richest Americans and unabashed about employing the most cynical of maneuvers to achieve this goal, House Republicans left town this past weekend for their five-week August recess after shipping over to the Senate a noxious package that combines an increase in the minimum wage with an outrageous near repeal of the estate tax and an extension of expiring tax breaks. The House GOP win-win political calculation here is obvious. Marrying a tax break for the rich with a wage hike for the poor dares senators in an election year to cast a vote against increasing the minimum wage. Because you got to remember what the old Rove mantra is. Because, you know, voting against this thing is going to require explanation to the folks back home. And Rove has said time and again, if you're explaining, you're losing. If you're explaining, you're losing. of course, I remember, as do the folks in the chat room. I remember when there was a very simple slogan of our own. It's the economy, stupid. Meanwhile, what is the Republican sleaze machine doing in Ohio? Two things. The Ohio Republican Party's recently hired social conservative coordinator, that means outreach guy for the mouth breathers, is a guy named Gary Lankford. And he sent a mass email out to the mouth breathers, pro-family friends, that was a sleaze job on Congressman Ted Strickland, who is the Democratic nominee for governor in that state against Kent. What do you think you are trying to vote? Strickland. Blackwell, sorry.
Yeah.
Kent Blackwell. What is this? Now, who's Ted Strickland? Among other things, Ted Strickland is an ordained Methodist minister who's been out on the stump beating the Republicans over their own heads with his faith. That's hard for Republicans to deal with. So how are they getting back at him? With a whispering campaign. They're implying that Ted Strickland is gay. Lankford links to an internet posting by a conservative operative that's headlined, "Article adds fire to Strickland gay rumors." The posting suggests that a mid-June Toledo Blade newspaper article implies the Stricklands are both gay. He and his wife. Because they have separate residences. Then there's Ken Melman, chairman of the... and then there's David Dreyer. We'll leave the log closet alone. It will not end until we end it for them. It will not end until we teach them never to do this filthy crap again. One last thing, Cleveland Plain Dealer. As a shock tactic, a national group that opposes abortion plans to fly a billboard-sized picture of an aborted fetus over Cleveland beginning Monday. Oh, rednecks. Nah, I'm not going to say that. Agent Fred would get me. The Center for Bioethical Reform. Boy, that sounds like they must be scientists. Which frequently employs such attention-grabbing advertising hopes to jar people into reconsidering their support of abortion. Director Greg Cunningham said. Morning, Mr. Cunningham. He said the banner would be the most graphic picture ever displayed from the air. Well, you know, thanks, Greg. And, you know, it's going to be a dummied-up, ginned-up, faked-up photo. And they're going to fly it, the airspace, by law, belongs to the people of the United States. If I was on terrestrial radio, I would be hard-pressed in this repressive atmosphere to say booger and not fear the wrath of the FCC. And yet these clowns are going to be allowed by the Bush FAA to fly an aerial hazard over Cleveland. Hard to keep your eye on the road out there on I-77 when you're looking up at the big flying fetus. More on that tomorrow night. Thanks, Agnes. We got to get out of here. What a wonderful evening it was. Thank you to everyone who joined in. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Al Stewart. My darling wife, Agnes, produced the program. Brian Reznor announces. John Fox in Sydney, Australia, is the chief engineer of the Head On Radio Network. Peter Godbold of Godbold Computer Services in Tallahassee, Florida, is our IT professional. Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org maintains the streams and the archives and the podcasting of all the programs on the Head On Radio Network and does a Jim Dandy job of it in the process. He's finishing up a fundraiser. Help put him over the top so I can stop telling you to do the right thing. Many thanks to Shelby LaPrey at RadioPower.org and her efforts in spreading hope and knowledge and facts via the progressive talk portion of